You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It is my great privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Samantha Nutt. She is a doctor. She is a longtime worker in humanitarian aid in war zones around the world. She is the author of a wonderful book called Damned Nations, Greed, Guns, Armies, and Aid. She is also the founder of War Child, an organization in Canada, and she gives a wonderful talk on TED Talks that you can find under the title The Real Harm of the Global Arms Trade. Samantha Nutt, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Well, thanks very much, David. I really appreciate it.
Well, it's great to have you on here. I loved your book. I particularly loved the topic that comes up in the talk you gave to TED Talks about the damage that arms dealing does to the world and to aid efforts and so on. Can you talk about where arms come from, where they go, and how they impact world affairs?
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, certainly I can. You know, I've come, as you can imagine, working in war zones around the world over the span of about 20-plus years now. I've obviously come face-to-face with a number of different armed groups, and in particular, children who are carrying automatic rifles and who have killed with those rifles, and yet some of those kids, which is a point I make in my TED Talk, have never been to school. And so as a public health doctor, you know, one of the things that we do as public health doctors is we are trained to look at, well, what are the risks and what are the threats to people's health and well-being and what interventions are most likely to make the biggest difference and to reduce the death toll. And increasingly, as I was working in different war zones around the world from Somalia to Eastern Congo, the preponderance of small arms, light weapons that were readily accessible to militia groups and cheap and widely available, that to me became one of the greatest obstacles to the entire humanitarian response. People who needed access to those services were not able to get it because they were constantly facing threats and intimidation, and their movements were being blocked, and women were experiencing high rates of sexual violence. And at the same time, those aid organizations that were trying to get to those groups most at need were also impeded in those efforts. And that became the basis, really, for my own deep dive into this question of arms and where they're going and what they're being used for, but more importantly, where they come from. Because we're used to seeing these kinds of images of child soldiers around the world. And the question that rarely gets asked, unfortunately, is, well, what is the source of these weapons and how is this even possible? And that's what I tried to focus on during my TED Talk.
And what country, for anyone who may be in the dark on this, is the top arms dealer to the world?
Well, certainly the United States is. It's responsible for about half of all arms transactions in the world. But, you know, within that, it's also very difficult to, say, compare U.S. arms transactions to countries such as Russia and China because the level of reporting from those nations is spotty at best and deliberately hard to find. But by and large, when it comes to the sale of military equipment around the world, about 80% of it, if you include all military hardware, comes from the five permanent members of the United Nations Security Council. So it's the United States, it's Russia, China, Britain, France, and increasingly Germany, so what we would consider to be the P5 plus one. And small arms effectively follow that kind of pattern, less so in terms of England's role when it comes to small arms, but certainly other countries gain prominence.
And you cite in your talk, this was a year ago, I don't know if it's changed significantly, but that small arms, light weapons sales have tripled in the past 15 years, and deaths resulting from them have also tripled, suggesting that we might want to see some cause and effect there.
That's right. And as you know, from a medical point of view, from a health point of view, proving causality is much more involved than just saying, well, look, there's a relationship between this outcome and this event. But it does suggest, and this is the point that I was trying to make, that the widespread availability of these weapons, that is inherently destabilizing. And the more weapons you have, and the more weapons you have access to, and this is a pattern we see all around the world, the more likely you will see within that population deaths as a result of gun violence. And that's true whether you're talking about the United States or whether you're talking about countries that are experiencing active armed conflict. And so that was what I was trying to point out to the TED audience, is to say, okay, look, we can't show that X equals Y, that is a direct relationship, but certainly the evidence is strong enough and overwhelming enough that we really ought to be critically looking at this issue.
It seems to me, and I know historical analogies are not perfect, but it seems to me that it was European colonists, settlers, who pushed alcohol on Native Americans and then thought of them as all a bunch of drunks, although they weren't producing their own alcohol. And it was you Americans and Brits who pushed opium on China and then thought of the Chinese as a bunch of drug addicts, although they weren't the ones dealing the stuff. And here in the United States, people mostly think of the Middle East and Africa as sort of inherently violent places, places where people, because of something in their nature, kill a lot of each other with guns all the time, and never stop and think where the guns are produced, where the weapons are made, who's selling them, who's profiting from them. Is that a fair comparison, and do we need to radically change how we think of the violence in these distant places?
I certainly believe that we need to think very critically about violence and the root causes of violence and the factors that will inflame tensions and inflame violence. And if you look at the long lens of history, I mean, you've got a number of different factors that will contribute to violence and instability in different corners of the world. You've got a history of colonialism, even looking, for example, at the war in the Eastern Congo. The war in the Eastern Congo, a country formerly called Zaire, is considered to be the worst war in terms of the numbers of civilians killed since World War II. They've lost about 5 million people directly and indirectly as a result of that conflict over the past 16 years. And if you look at, there's a fabulous book that was written by Adam Hochschild on this called King Leopold's Ghost, and if you look at the history of Belgium and the colonial power there and how that pandered to different groups, how it set up some groups to have leadership positions and not others, how they were the ones who introduced penalties of amputating hands and feet for not complying with Belgian demands and their sort of rabid consumption of resources, which was that time at the rubber trade, that these were all significant contributing factors. And then they would prop up regimes on their way out, even as colonialism was coming to a close. They would prop up regimes that would then continue those sort of favored nation relationships with some of those colonial powers. And deliberately, in the case of the Congo, squeezing out to the point of until he was killed, the socialist front runner in that part of the world, Patrice Lumumba, and propping up, much more unsavory regimes. And all of these things lead to this kind of legacy of violence and instability. And at the same time, even if you look at the arms trade, you've got countries that are at war, which is one of the things I show in my TED Talk, primarily concentrated in the global south and in the Middle East. And then if you look at the countries where the weapons are originating from, similar to your point on Native Americans, I mean, the countries profiting from that transaction are primarily in the global north. And I mean, there are exceptions to that, but primarily in the global north. And this is a pattern that you do see, unfortunately, all around the world. And when you throw those weapons into an already highly unstable environment where the borders were imposed, where in many cases the leadership and the governance was imposed, it is a recipe for humanitarian disaster.
Very well said. I think we should note that Lumumba was not just killed by anyone, but was killed by Belgium with assistance from the CIA.
That's correct. I mean, I didn't want to that's a whole other conversation.
Oh,
that
sure.
Could take up our 30 minutes. So,
absolutely.
But it's very well documented, and certainly, as I said, the King Leopold's Ghost is an excellent book, which just shows how deep those colonial and destructive those colonial influences were in that region.
Indeed, and there's another author who's been on this program and should be familiar to our listeners. I think we should also give a footnote to Vietnam, if you include Laos and Cambodia, as certainly rivaling the death toll in the Congo. But but that's well known, and the Congo is not well known. And everybody says not another Rwanda, without noting what caused it, and nobody ever says not another Congo, although the death toll so much higher, and the support for a killer like Paul Kagame, the president of Rwanda at the time of and leading up to the disaster in Rwanda, part of what's fueled the killing in the Congo. We seem to have a selective sort of outrage based on the politics of the nation we live in and the news sources of the nation we live in.
Well, and who our allies are as well, and we do tend to we like to reduce war down to very tidy narratives of good guys and bad, or so-called good guys and bad guys, but the reality is it's much more complicated and complex and nuanced, and it does require that we dive into it and that we think in full paragraphs. And Kagame is a perfect example, which you raised, president of Rwanda, who has been actively backing the rebels in eastern Congo for a very long time, contributing to that violence and instability. You've got the exchange of resources that are being mined in the eastern Congo that are making their way out of Rwanda and being sold in exchange for cash and for weapons. And there's no denying that that has certainly added fuel to that particular conflict. And that's not even to mention some of the extrajudicial executions that he is accused of having been involved in, where they have assassinated Rwandan dissidents in other parts of the world. So, it is a very intertwined, murky, and complex conflict, and that's only one example. I mean, I can't even cite a single conflict where those kinds of realities don't apply.
Yeah, we're speaking with Samantha Nutt, whose book is Damned Nations, and I highly recommend it. Much of the book has to do with aid, which is the field you work in, and I was very interested in your descriptions in Somalia and elsewhere of how the United States and other nations using the military to provide so-called aid actually hurts aid and hurts the ability of independent organizations to portray themselves as neutral, and the ability of local residents to trust foreigners who are coming to help them. Can you talk about how using militaries for aid might not be the best approach to aid?
Yes, I can, David. I think you captured that really, really accurately there, in that it, increasingly, particularly starting in the 1990s, although it does certainly predate that, but NATO states in particular have taken up this baton of winning hearts and minds and being seen as people who are rebuilding nation states and not simply destroying them or waging war. And we saw the use of soldiers involved in humanitarian affairs in Somalia under the Operation Restore Hope banner, where they were in charge of bringing in food for distribution. We certainly saw it in Afghanistan, where you had foreign troops engaged in school reconstruction and wells and those kinds of community-based programs. And it's frankly continued. I mean, we've seen it in Iraq and we've seen it elsewhere. And what's been happening as a result, both directly and indirectly, is it has blurred the lines between military affairs and humanitarian affairs to the point where the idea of a humanitarian space has just completely evaporated. And increasingly, you're seeing more and more aid workers who are being killed in the line of duty. Even if you just look at the Syrian crisis for one moment, and I'm back from the region myself. I was actually in Iraq last week. And you see the targeting of MSF, Doctors Without Borders hospitals, and other hospitals and civilian affairs. And you know, there's this sense that the business of saving lives is no longer distinct from the business of taking them. And so aid workers are being seen as part of that extension of a broader Western agenda, and therefore they're being seen as targets, and they're being abducted and kidnapped and assaulted at increasingly devastating rates. And the impact of that from a humanitarian perspective is that it makes it that much harder for aid organizations to operate and to help civilians survive and recover as a result of war. Our hands are effectively tied. And it's almost to the point now where I don't even know how you begin to undo that. It is so enmeshed in just this sense that all aid now is just part of a broader military agenda, and it's extremely unfortunate and so harmful to the humanitarian movement writ large.
And yet there is this big thirst in Western societies and around the world to do what help we can do, and there are people trying to deliver emergency aid themselves as amateurs to places that have faced disasters, whether natural or human-made, and yet you describe many of those efforts also as not being well thought out and doing more harm than good. Is that right? Are people who take matters into their own hands without looking to an expert organization likely to hurt the situation?
It's certainly the case that any one of us, if we were to go to a hospital or if we were affected by some kind of natural disaster, or even when we send our kids to school, we expect the people that we are dealing with who are there to help us and to support us to be trained and qualified for the task. And unfortunately, the humanitarian movement has experienced, particularly over the past decade, maybe even for 15 years, this kind of boom in untrained, unqualified, well-intended foreigners who want to be at the center of the action, and in many cases can do a lot more harm than good. Africa in particular, and this is the point that I make in Damnation, is plagued by our misspent altruism from this side of the world. You know, when you look at the loss of hundreds of thousands of textile jobs in Africa, that can be directly linked back to the trade in used clothing originating from our side of the world. So we think that we're doing a good thing. We take our clothes, our surplus goods, we drop them in a community drop box, and we believe that they're going to go to somebody who needs it, not realizing that, in fact, many of those goods end up being resold into foreign markets. They flood those markets with cheap apparel, and they put those local tailors and those local textile workers out of jobs. And many of those will be women, for example, women who are involved in tailoring and selling their goods at market, and it exacerbates already chronic levels of poverty. And we certainly, I don't want to belabor this for you, I could talk about this for hours, but, you know, we also saw this during the Haitian earthquake. We saw this glut of inexperienced people who went overseas and who, frankly, were in the way. And we need to remember that good intentions alone do not guarantee the best outcomes. You have to be trained and qualified, and you have to know what you're doing. Otherwise, I can't emphasize this enough. You'll make a much more significant contribution if you stayed home and donate the airfare that you would have paid to be at the center of the action.
Your book, Damned Nation, has lots of good advice on how people should do aid. But obviously, one option that we haven't tried would be for our governments to invest in aid on something like the scale they invest in killing. I think the United States is the extreme in both regards, perhaps, putting across multiple departments and agencies some $1 trillion a year into war and war preparations. As far as I can tell, around $30 billion or less into actual non-military aid. If the world were to put, I think you use the figure $1.5 trillion, others use the figure $2 trillion that the world spends on militarism every year. If the world's governments were to put that kind of resources into aid, what could be accomplished?
think a tremendous amount could be accomplished. As you said, we roughly right now spend about 12 times in terms of our military spending on what we do on humanitarian assistance. So 12 times in terms of one twelfth of what gets spent in terms of military spending is what we spend on humanitarian aid. So it's the things like food and water and ensuring kids have access to education and promoting human rights and good governance in different corners of the world. And we need to change that balance. There's no question that we are investing disproportionately in the weapons of our own destruction. And while at the same time, we are not really investing enough in reducing those threats over the long term. And we know that education is inherently stabilizing for communities and for countries. We know that good governance takes years to implement and a lot of training and a lot of resources. Similarly, we know that breaking the back of that climate of impunity that plagues many war-torn nations requires a strong, functioning judicial system and a free press, and that takes investment and training. We know that disarmament is critical as well in terms of reducing those threats. And the illicit trade of resources and narco trafficking, I mean, their list is extremely long. And that if we were to invest in those things, that over time, you would be much less likely to see countries and communities that are at high risk of violence and poverty. And thus reducing the need for that military spending. And unfortunately, though, and this is true for anything as a public health doctor, this is true for healthcare too, it's often so hard to convince people to invest in prevention that we tend to find ourselves just trying to do the high-cost management at the back end and not necessarily see the kinds of impacts we can have on the front end that would save us so much expense and so much heartache over the long term.
Absolutely. And of course, the United States and other nations like it could invest in disarmament simply by ceasing to arm and investing in other industries that are more peaceful and better economically. And one way we could do that your book suggests outside of gaining a representative, responsible, law-abiding government would be to divest. I mean, you point out that teachers' unions in New York, for example, have their retirement investments in weapons manufacture so that teachers who ought to be lobbying for a shift of resources toward useful things, including education, have a financial motive for cheering for weapons sales as a way to a secure retirement. How do we begin a campaign to really divest from war? I mean, there are campaigns to divest from nuclear weapons in particular, or from Israeli weapons in particular, but how do we go after one investment fund at a time? Do we go after one weapons manufacturer at a time? How do we really build a divestment campaign from war and weapons entirely?
That's something, to be honest with you, that I've spent a lot of time considering. And of course, there's a certain amount of cynicism that exists in the world around the power of divestment to actually influence change. But I do see evidence increasingly that shareholders are looking at risk, right? And so they are looking at, well, what is the risk to this business if it's caught up in unsavory things in another part of the world. And, you know, it would be wonderful if businesses would be moral and ethical entities, but if they're at least willing to consider the question from a fiduciary point of view, you know, ultimately, hopefully, it will get us to the same place. And so, I mean, I personally think that when it comes to public sector funds, that there has to be a higher level of ethical screening and due diligence, and that arms manufacturers in particular, that if you are a public sector worker, which means you are invested in the public good, that investing in arms ought to be anathema in that particular equation. It should not represent the ethos and the philosophy of people who are dedicated to public service. And, for example, Norway has done this. I mean, Norway, for their government funds, for their public funds, they shortlist every year companies that they feel are ineligible, which includes even things like certain mining companies and arms manufacturers and others. And so it is possible to come up with an agreed-upon list of eligible and ineligible companies based on their track record. And I think that that would have a very powerful impact on companies that are behind the times in terms of doing that kind of due diligence and making sure that they're not contributing to suffering in other corners of the world. In terms of how to do it, the Small Arms Survey has quite a lot of information around arms and where they're going and what they're being used for, but so does a group called SIPRI, which is the Stockholm-based Peace Research Institute, and it's for listeners that are interested in this, it's SIPRI.org, and every year they publish the list of the world's top 100 arms manufacturers. And unfortunately, it's often the case that it might be a portion of the business, but not the entire business. So the portion of the business that, might manufacture fridges and telephones and microwaves, and then the other portion also manufactures military hardware. And it will be up to those public sector groups and funds to determine what proportion is too much, and to come up with their own criteria. But I would say even if you pick the top 10 in terms of their global contribution to the arms trade and divest from those, that's an important start, and it sends a very important message.
Yeah, and public sector funds are typically obliged to make public where they're investing their money, right? So we should be able to find out weapons manufacturers, large and small, that a federal or state fund is invested in. Is that right?
Well, you would hope so. Certainly when I was doing the research for my book, I tried to get information from both state teachers' pension funds and provincial in Canada teachers' pension funds, and many of them only report if it's a certain level of investment, or they make it extremely difficult to find out, or they hide behind the sort of fiduciary requirements that investment firms have. And by that I mean that legally they are bound to do what is in the best interest of their stakeholders, which means that they're duty-bound to create the highest possible return. Otherwise, they're not in compliance themselves. And so they'll hide behind that as a reason for not being able to create any kind of divestment or ethical policy, because the fiduciary requirements are not around ethics. The fiduciary requirements are around maximizing returns. But I've had conversations with a number of different fund management folks around this, and I think that's a very cynical way of looking at it. I think it is possible to do well and to do good, and that if this issue was more rigorously studied to look at, well, what happens when you divest versus what happens if you just invest in more progressive, ethically sound businesses, I think people would be surprised. I think that actually you still would be generating returns that would be acceptable to those shareholders.
Wonderful advice that I, among others, are going to start working on, and I hope some listeners will join in. We've been speaking with Samantha Nutt. Her book is Damned Nations, Greed, Guns, Armies, and Aid. Check it out. I highly recommend it. Samantha Nutt, thank you for taking the time to come on Talk Nation Radio.
Thanks so much, David. I really appreciate it.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, from vanishing ice to animal die-offs to increasing wildfires, scientists use words like unprecedented and staggering to describe the evident impacts of human-driven climate disruption. Elite media say they take it all very seriously. How far are they from taking it seriously enough? Dar Jamail is a staff reporter at Truthout and author of a number of books, including Beyond the Green Zone, Dispatches from an Unembedded Journalist in Occupied Iraq, and the forthcoming The End of ICE. We'll talk with him about that. Also on the show, that Donald Trump has found a way to avoid paying federal income tax, and that he and his followers think that's genius, is the opposite of surprising. But what of the response from some in the press that the culprit is a tax code that's too complicated? We'll get some clarity from Richard Phillips, senior policy analyst with Citizens for Tax Justice. That's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at recent press. More than 100 deaths have been reported, but the extent of the damage exacted by Hurricane Matthew on Haiti is not yet known. But with the storm moving towards the U.S., media, too, are moving, leaving in their wake the sort of stories you would predict. Fragile Haiti in the line of fire from Matthew. Impoverished Haiti braces for catastrophic floods as hurricane approaches. And from the New York Times, a list of previous disasters in Haiti, a land all too familiar with hardship. It's hard to wish for more of this sad, static storyline, even as research shows a relationship between the amount of media coverage a disaster receives and the generosity of the response in terms of aid. In a piece for Common Dreams, anthropologist Mark Schuller explains that the relatively high media profile of Haiti's 2010 earthquake came at a price. Quote, "With stories of devastation appearing to many foreign observers as hell on earth, with phrases like state failure often repeated, foreign media coverage also naturalized foreign control of the response." Close quote. Media's disaster narrative, Schuller notes, shapes the response, with all of its messages about who is a hero and whose efforts are ignored. Journalists could find a new approach by listening to Haitian scholars, journalists, and social movements who would prefer support for Haitian-led initiatives, attention to root causes, including neoliberal policies enforced by the U.S., and the participation of local groups in identifying and prioritizing the work to be done. They'd take that over a dozen more sympathetic stories about poor Haiti and its beleaguered people. U.S. media saw a story in the work boycott and street protests by some 6 million women in Poland that led to a reversal of government plans to put through a complete ban on abortion, including in cases of rape or danger to a woman's life. Stories in major U.S. outlets pointed out that Poland's laws are already among the most restrictive in Europe. And they noted the concerns of human rights advocates that the ban would criminalize women and doctors and make women who have miscarriages subjects of suspicion and investigation. It was good to see, but it did make one wonder if those conditions are unacceptable, they are unacceptable, whether they're de jure or de facto, right? But there are numerous places in the United States where women face real substantive barriers to abortion. A set of maps from Glamour magazine's Abortion in America series illustrates the numerous states with parental notice and consent laws, waiting periods, travel requirements, the states that ban certain procedures or that prevent private insurers from covering abortion or that force counseling on women. American women, in other words, don't need to look afield to find a crisis. It's not clear that the U.S. press corps has heard that message. One indicator, so far there have been zero questions asked about abortion in either the presidential or vice presidential debates. And finally, on the homepage of the New York Times, October 5th, the lead story bears the headline, Contractor for NSA Charged in Possible New Theft of Secrets, describing the arrest of Harold T. Martin III, a contractor for the National Security Agency accused of taking classified documents. The homepage teaser reports, the arrest raises the embarrassing prospect that for the second time in 3 years, a contractor managed to steal secrets. The main story continues that same emphasis. Quote, the arrest raises the embarrassing prospect that for the second time in 3 years, a contractor for the consulting company Booz Allen Hamilton managed to steal highly damaging secret information while working for the NSA. In 2013, Edward J. Snowden, who was also a Booz Allen contractor, took a vast trove of documents from the agency that were later passed to journalists, exposing surveillance programs in the United States and abroad, close quote. Well, the problem with all this talk about the theft and the stealing of secrets is that while Snowden has indeed been charged by the federal government with theft, along with 2 violations of the Espionage Act, he's been convicted of no crime. Were he to stand trial, he would no doubt try to offer a public interest defense of his actions, as the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe has urged that he be allowed to do, saying that the need to expose government wrongdoing overrode the law against unauthorized release of government documents. Now, the New York Times might think that such a defense would be unsuccessful. No doubt many experts would agree. But it's unusual for the journalist to assume that someone accused of a crime is guilty, in effect taking the role of judge and jury upon themselves. Such an assumption is particularly problematic in this case because the same section of the legal code that's used to charge Snowden with theft of any record, voucher, money, or thing of value also criminalizes whoever receives, conceals, or retains the same with intent to convert it to his use or gain, knowing it to have been embezzled, stolen, purloined, or converted. Well, there's no exception for journalists there, any more than there's an exception for whistleblowers. So if we're going to call Snowden's documents stolen, then journalists often receive stolen records from sources and use them as the basis for stories, as the Times itself has done with documents released by Snowden. In other words, if Snowden is a thief, then the New York Times is a fence. One shouldn't have to point out to journalists that this interpretation of the law is not compatible with the First Amendment or with democracy. When exposing evidence of government crimes is a crime, there's no check on the power of the state. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. New research on attitudes to climate change suggests that people believe they are entitled to their own facts on the matter, even as scientific evidence points one way, only one way, and every day more urgently. Corporate media bear some responsibility, years of matching every piece of evidence with some statement of doubt or denial, years of placing scientific consensus alongside politicians' folkloric ideas as though they merited the same sort of attention. Even today, media say the words about human-caused climate disruption being a very important problem that requires immediate attention, but it somehow doesn't merit a single question so far in the presidential or vice presidential debates. So are media treating climate disruption seriously, much less seriously enough? We're joined now by Dar Jamail, staff reporter at Truthout and author of, among other titles, The End of ICE, which is forthcoming from the New Press. He joins us by phone from Washington State. Welcome back to Counterspin, Dar Jamail.
Great to be with you.
Let me ask you first about language. I noticed that you use the term ACD, or anthropogenic climate disruption. I take it you find that a more satisfying descriptor than just climate change or certainly global warming.
It's more scientifically accurate, and it leaves no room for error, which, given the climate that those of us reporting about climate disruption are in this country right now, with denial continuing, which is amazing to me, I use it to be as specific and accurate as possible. So when the denialists say climate is always changing, they are factually correct. And this way, it's being disrupted by the introduction of massive amounts of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. And it's human-caused, hence anthropogenic. So this way, it just basically leaves no room for error and no wiggle room for the denialists.
And that language can help, as you're saying, really help shape the conversation. I appreciate that. Well, if you tried to understand the United States 2016 approach to anthropogenic climate disruption from media coverage, I think you'd be very confused. You'll find a story in the October 4th New York Times chastising media for going a little crazy just because we passed what the paper called the unhappy milestone, in which CO2 levels that usually drop in September instead stayed above 400 parts per million. You won't, though, find many stories actually going crazy about that fact, which is perhaps why the Times' only example is Vice Motherboard. You'll find stories saying how important it is that the Paris Agreement gets firmed up right away. But then there's an item about how a group of senators wants to declare the burning of forests carbon neutral, because after all, trees grow back. And that's kind of a back pager. You know, now, maybe that confusion just reflects confused policy, but big picture, how far is so-called mainstream media coverage from where it needs to be?
Well, the short answer to that would be, and that's something that people could write several books about, but it's a situation where look at the coverage that you've been exposed to, and everyone right off the top of their head has an idea of what that is, and you just talked about several really, really good examples of that, and let's then hold that up to the fact that there's as much CO2 in the atmosphere now as there was during the Pleistocene period 15 million years ago, at which point the oceans were 80 feet higher. So another way to put that is we've had recent reports that I just wrote about that we published on Monday that came out, one of them showing that the ocean conveyor belt is actually slowing down, which basically is a giant underwater current that transfers energy around the globe and couldn't play a much more critical role in the entire climatological system of the planet. And the study is worried because they're worried about any change of this could, quote, jam the world's ocean circulation. And then another recent report coming out talking about how the temperatures in Earth's oceans are the greatest challenge of our generation and are going off the charts and continuing to warm even as we're moving into fall. So just off the top of my head, a few of these things that are extremely alarming. I mean, all the warning signs are there loud and clear, and they keep getting more intense by the month, and yet mainstream coverage of climate disruption is not keeping a pace.
Well, not to put too fine a point on it, if we want to keep the Earth's temperature from rising more than this 2 degrees Celsius, which we understand is the upper limit, you know, that has been identified, we really can't do any more new digging or drilling. Is that correct? Like zero?
Not only that is absolutely correct. And not only that, but there needs to be ways to start getting carbon out of the atmosphere, because what's already in the atmosphere, according to the head of the UN's Environment Program, who stated this just about a month before the Paris talks last December, she said that if we stopped all CO2 emissions on a dime right this minute, there's already enough CO2 in the atmosphere that we're going to hit 3.5°C by the year 2100. So we need to stop on a dime. Any more drilling and discovering new fields and exploiting them, et cetera, has to be not even considered. And then we need to be finding more ways of sequestration, of getting more carbon out of the atmosphere, meaning more forests, more work on soils, et cetera, but literally causing a negative trend instead of even just breaking even at this point.
See, I just don't feel as though that's really taken as seriously, as taken as meaning what it says. I think for many in the media, keep it in the ground is kind of a slogan, you know, and not really something that is the actual thing that policy has to start from, the square one of it.
Well, that's exactly right. And unfortunately, I think it's just going to take a continuing worsening of the crisis, which we're guaranteed to have, until more global governments start to act. And that's why we're seeing these letters being penned and signed on to by hundreds of the most distinguished climate scientists on the planet, urging governments to act, that, look, we're beyond a point of no return. We need to start taking dramatic, serious changes. And there's frustration throughout the scientific community, the people producing these ongoing reports about different aspects of climate disruption, because the reports are coming out, the facts are there. We really have all the information that we need to know, and yet governments are lagging so far behind and pushing through the dramatic policies that we really have to see put into effect.
Yes, I think scientists maybe are even shocked that they can say this is what needs to happen, and politicians will still say, yeah, we feel like we can negotiate a different outcome. You know, it's almost as though they're mindsets that don't mesh, and I guess I think that's where reporters could step into the breach, you know, and talk about the gap between the way politicians talk, just by their nature, and what really has to happen.
I think that journalists at this point, given the situation, are in a position where we are obliged to step in and do that, because scientists can't. They're responsible simply for producing the data and the reports. Their job is not to go out and promote them. That's our job, is to bring attention to these reports and then put the results more in lay language so that readers can understand what they mean. And that's just not being done enough. There's certainly plenty of room where folks can do a lot more of that. And that's what I try to do every month in my dispatch, of put all of these recent reports together over the previous 30 days so that people can see, wow, when you look at this in total and look at the entire web, we are in hot water, and we really need to be holding politicians and policymakers' feet to the proverbial fire.
We've been speaking with Dar Jamail. You can find his work, including the latest, Scientists Sound Alarm on Climate, But U.S. Still Toys with Skepticism, on truthout.org. Dar Jamail, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
My pleasure. Thank you.
In case you somehow managed to miss it, Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump acknowledged in the most recent debate that for at least some period of time, he paid no federal income tax, explaining characteristically, "That makes me smart." The statement revealed nothing we didn't know about Trump, but it did raise a few questions for some folks about taxes, who pays what and why. Richard Phillips is senior policy analyst at Citizens for Tax Justice and the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. He joins us by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Counterspin, Richard Phillips.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, the New York Times did some looking at what tax return information they could get about Trump, and a lot of eyes are on the fact that in 1995, he claimed more than $900 million in losses. And this, we're to understand, could be claimed against earnings in future years, such that it's possible his taxes could have been zero for maybe 18 years. Now, no doubt there's much more to it than that. But as a point of information, this whole idea, this basic idea of deducting your losses from your future income, not everybody is allowed to do that.
That's definitely true. And in the most common example for middle-income families, if your house loses value, as a lot of houses did in the 2008 financial crisis, then you don't get to subtract out, you know, the loss of that to your income in a given year, but Donald Trump got to subtract out the losses of his real estate assets going downhill.
Now, the reason for that phenomenon, some would call it a loophole, but there's a reason for it, and I understand that that's because the idea was that it would spur investment or that it would spur job creation, but has that been borne out?
So the whole idea of net operating losses, which is what he experienced doing this, for business makes a lot of sense, because if a business in 1 year makes $100 and the next year loses $200, it seems a little strange to hit them with more taxes when they're not actually making money. Mm-hmm. So we don't have a huge problem with net operating losses to some extent, but I think there's two unique ways that Donald Trump, we know because he's in the real estate industry, Donald Trump is taking advantage of this. One way is that he gets to use a lot of his business losses to cover his own personal income losses. So it's not that, oh, well, within his business itself, he can subtract out the losses from other losses or from other income in his business, but he can actually use that to wipe out his earnings from, say, the money they paid him to be on The Apprentice. And that's something that not all businesses and not all people can do. And then the second unique thing about the real estate industry is that in many cases, and for Donald Trump we know this is true, that they actually get to take losses based on loans that they are not actually invested in. So in many cases, Donald Trump wasn't putting up all the money to build a building. He was actually taking out very large loans. And so he gets to take the losses on those investments, even though he wasn't necessarily making the full investment.
Well, and the rules that allow for that, I think some people may believe, well, yes, they happen to benefit individuals like Donald Trump, but they're in place because they also benefit the economy as a whole. And I guess my question is, does that seem to be the case?
We don't think that these kinds of rules for real estate investors are uniquely helpful to the economy. We think that real estate investors should be treated like any other business or any other businessmen, you know, just be required to pay the taxes they own, not get these kinds of special tax breaks. So no, I don't see any reason for us to be disproportionately benefiting the real estate industry. In fact, I think the real estate industry is profitable enough on its own that it doesn't need special tax breaks to enhance it.
Well, recognition that the tax code can favor the wealthy and can favor businesses and particularly real estate has kind of morphed in the public conversation into the tax code is too complicated.
Yeah.
In which light, I was really intrigued by a comment from CTJ's Bob McIntyre, who said the complexity comes from trying to stop people who have found ways around the simplicity. What is he getting at there?
Well, I think people have this sense that it's really easy to figure out what income is. We should just have your income and then multiply it by a rate, and that's all that you have to do. But the problem is that lots of people have figured out ways to make their income a little more complicated. And just using the Donald Trump example, it's actually a little hard to figure out year to year exactly how much Donald Trump is making or losing, and thus what his income is. And so what people like Donald Trump or other wealthy people do is they figure out ways to make what could be income look like losses, or because the tax codes in some cases treats different types of income differently, to shift all of your income into be the less taxed version. The issue is it's inherently hard to kind of get at what income is, and thus it can't be sort of as simple as people want it to be, because the accountants always try to figure out ways to get around them.
Yeah, I'll never forget, no matter how hard I try, a scene in the movie Born Rich, in which Ivanka Trump is describing her father pointing to a homeless man and saying, that guy has $8 billion more dollars than me, you know, because yeah. Trump was in debt at the time. And I feel like you can explain about how certain things are on paper and they're not real, but those stories hold a lot of meaning for people, you know, tax code, whatever. This guy was in a hole deeper than a homeless guy, you know, and he made it all back. I think it's kind of hard sometimes to translate this information.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of our hardest tasks in explaining the tax code, and also one of the reasons why the tax code has become so rigged, is because it's become this place for different accountants or tax lawyers to argue. And at that point, it's hard for the American people to kind of engage and figure out, well, what is the loophole and what is the legitimate deduction?
Well, the corporate tax rate has come up in debates, and we've heard offshoring. It's presented by Republicans in the main as being the result of the fact that corporate taxes in the United States are too high. I feel like I've been hearing that for a very long time. It seems like something you ought to be able to say, well, here's the answer to that, relatively. I mean, how much credence do we give this line about corporate taxes being too high and about that being the reason for offshoring?
Well, I think the number one talking point from corporations is that the corporate tax rate is too high, but what they tend to focus on is the statutory tax rate, which is 35%, rather than the effective tax rate that companies are actually paying. And the reality is that that rate is a lot lower than 35%. In fact, a study by Citizens for Tax Justice found that it was around 19% for major profitable companies. So we push that out there and say that, yes, the rate is lower, but it doesn't stop the corporations from claiming over and over again that they're actually paying 35, or the 35 rate is the rate that everyone should be paying attention to.
And I guess if you asked those corporations about paying that lesser rate, they would say that makes them smart. You know, I mean, after all, that is what they have tax lawyers to help with. Well, a lot of the problem, it seems like, that you're laying out has to do not so much with the information not existing, but with a certain kind of opacity, with the inability to get at that information or to use it in an accessible way. So what is this Financial Accounting Standards Board, and how hopeful should we be about that?
Well, so the Financial Accounting Standards Board and also the Securities and Exchange Commission have both been kind of reviewing their standards on what companies are required to disclose in terms of how much they're paying in taxes and how much income they're earning in every country. And so we recently put out a report called Offshore Shell Games, where we kind of took a look at how much companies were paying offshore or how much they're holding offshore. And although we could get some pretty good estimates in terms of showing that Fortune 500 companies have about $2.5 trillion offshore, we were only in many cases able to estimate how much they actually owe in taxes on those things. And actually, we have no sense of where and how much money a given company has in, say, the Cayman Islands versus Germany. And so what we've been trying to push the Financial Accounting Standards Board to do and the Securities and Exchange Commission to do is require companies to list out the information on a country-by-country basis, things just like income, their tax, how much revenue. And that way, the public and investors would just have a better sense of what's really going on.
And I guess, you know, we would also know what could be invested in the U.S. economy. In other words, kind of what the mass amount is that's missing that could be put to work doing lots of other things.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is a tremendous amount of money they have offshore. I mean, our estimate based on the numbers we do have is that, that companies on that offshore stash owe about $718 billion. And that's a lot of money that could go to rebuilding roads, go to investing in childcare and healthcare, and go to all the different priorities that we have.
We've been speaking with Richard Phillips of Citizens for Tax Justice and the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. You can find their work online at ctj.org. Richard Phillips, thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
All right, great. Thanks for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find those on FAIR's website. It's FAIR.org, and that's the place to sign up for our Action Alert Network. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
This show is jam-packed with the voices of the climate crisis from around the world. We start in Moscow, where vast areas of Siberia have burned in September, the month when cold rains or even snow should have ended the fire season. It's yet another big sign of a world entering a time of climate chaos. Then we go for uncomfortable new science from Germany. A new major source of greenhouse gases has been uncovered, something completely missing from reports by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and all the talk of the remaining carbon budget. No, I'm not talking about methane from the Arctic or the shrinking reflective power of ice and snow around the planet. It's the forests. Even if we stopped all deforestation today, the carbon from tropical forests already cut in places like Brazil and Indonesia will continue to rise up into the atmosphere. It's as though we've uncovered a second fossil fuel civilization. Finally, the energy report that fuels even more stringent warnings from activist writers like Bill McKibben and George Monbiot. We talk with an author of the Sky's the Limit report. That says multinational companies and oil states should abandon right now any further exploration for new oil, gas, or coal. That means their book assets are inflated, and that means pension funds and investors should flee fossil fuel companies and their dependent industries. I don't think that goes far enough, and I'll tell you why. I'm Alex. Welcome to Radio EcoShock, where minds and hearts become energized. Alexei Yaroshenko leads the Forest Campaign for Greenpeace Russia. He has a PhD in botany and has published on the boreal forest. Yaroshenko says the fire danger in Russia is much greater than officially admitted. If so, the carbon plume going into the atmosphere is far more dangerous than reported. The whole story is lately missing in the West. From Moscow, Radio EcoShock is pleased to welcome Dr. Alexei Yaroshenko. Hello, Alexei.
Hello.
Thank you for joining us. I want to start with this. On September 9, the Washington Post reported that Greenpeace firefighters were beaten up in southern Russia by masked men carrying pistols and weapons. Alexei, who are these firefighters?
These firefighters is a team that we have for more than 10 years, people who are trained as a professional firefighter. They are volunteers, but they are professional forest firefighters. So this was an expedition of 14 people. Seven of them had official diploma of the head of firefighting team, forest firefighting team. And they do this work for many years, and they are especially good specialists in fighting peat and reed fires, tall grass fires.
Is it common for environmentalists to be attacked like that in Russia?
It is not day-to-day practice, everyday practice, but it is not very uncommon. So it happens from time to time. It was more common in the 90s, then there was some break in beginning of this century, and now it is going to be more and more common.
Let's get to the really big story, the fires of Siberia. Please take as long as you like to describe what has happened this summer and then the current situation.
This summer in Siberia, we had one of the biggest fire catastrophes for last decade, but actually we have catastrophic fires every year since 2010 in different parts of Russia. There are two reasons for it. One of the reasons is climate change. We have longer summer, longer drought. And another reason is that we have very unclever changes in our forest legislation. Actually, our forest service and forest firefighting system was destroyed by the new forest code that came in force in 2007. And this year we have about, we cannot say exact number of hectares yet, but it's definitely more than 8 million hectares of forest that were burned this year by forest fires. And what is unusual that we had big catastrophic fires in September. Usually in September in Siberia there is a autumn or beginning of winter even. So there should be cold rain and sometimes snow this time. But now we have catastrophic fires. The area burned was about 2 million hectares on the peak, and this peak was about September 21st, 22nd.
Many of my listeners do not know the map of Russia. Can you explain for our international audience where the worst fires have been burning?
This year it was near Baikal Lake and upstream of Yenisei and Angara and Lena rivers. So Yenisei and Lena are the biggest rivers in Siberia. So they start more or less in the same area in eastern Siberia. And there are two major administrative regions that were burned. It's Krasnoyarsk and Irkutsk. So most of fires happened in Krasnoyarsk and Irkutsk.
On September 23rd, the Siberian Times reported, and I quote, "So far, more than 3,000 residents have signed a petition to President Vladimir Putin and Emergencies Minister Vladimir Puchkov on website change.org under the headline, City of Bratsk is choking from smoke." Alexei Yaroshenko, please tell us, where is Bratsk and what are the residents experiencing there?
Bratsk is second biggest city in Irkutsk region. It's about 230,000 people. There is a big hydropower station and a big pulp mill. This city was covered with heavy smoke for about a month, and the peak was a week ago. So the schools were closed. It's not the only city where schools were closed. We had about 5 or 6 cities where schools were closed because of heavy smoke, but Bratsk is one of them. And people were very dismissed by the regional government and by all the authorities that instead of fighting fires, they tried to hide all of them, just simply not to report them and say that everything is under control, there are no big fires, and we have nothing to do.
But satellite pictures show a huge haze hanging over Siberia in September.
Yes, our estimation that there are about 5 million people that were affected by this smoke, and this is a large event for Siberia, which is generally not very populated, so 5 million, it's for Siberia, it's a huge amount of people. It's several dozens of schools that were closed, and there were many other problems, not only closing schools, and also there was problems with safety on traffic. For example, in some rivers, the navigation was closed or suspended for some time because of this smoke that didn't allow to see the shores and other ships.
And they need those rivers for supplies, I hear.
Yes, they need, because the rivers in Siberia are the major traffic lines. So it's also important to have these rivers open for traffic, for navigation. And the winter is coming, so they will be frozen quite soon.
All right. Now, on September 20th, the Siberian Times also reported, and I quote, "A fire threat to the Eastern Siberia Pacific Ocean pipeline led the Irkutsk Oil Company to suspend supplies of oil," said the official representative. Alexei, how close did these fires get to pipeline facilities?
They just come to the vicinity of pipelines in several in few times. They just reached the pipeline. But pipeline is under the ground, so most probably that this suspension of operations was related not to the fires that reached the pipelines, but to the heavy smoke that reached infrastructure like compression stations and so on. So people could not walk there. It's not very clear what was the story. Hidden from people who want to get information, but seems that the biggest reason for suspension was not the fire itself, but the smoke.
Has Siberia been warmer than usual in the last few years?
A bit warmer, but more problem that it was much drier, yes.
And you think that that is partly due to climate change?
Yes, it's definitely due to the climate change, because the trend is big and the area affected is very big. It cannot be related to any local activities.
How can you say, Alexei, that there are more fires than the government is reporting? What proof is there?
The proof comes from the remote sensing from satellites. So we are doing, we are watching the satellites and analyzing the development of fires on the day-to-day base. Also, there is a state-based system, ISDM, that monitors fires. It's also based on the remote sensing. It allows to get real data on forest fires, but these data are not used in official statistics, and they are not used for real management of fires.
Why would the government neglect to report the real situation?
I think that the main reason that almost every governmental bureaucrat want to keep his warm place and to stay on his position, not depending on the reality, and for him is much better and safer to hide information, to show that everything is okay, that to show problems. Nobody was punished in the last 7 years in Russia for hiding information about the forest fires, but many people were punished for bad statistics. So statistics, the paper reporting is more important for our governmental people than real situation in forests.
How has social media helped to alert the world to this problem?
There is some help from social media, but the problem is that many people who live in small settlements that are most affected in the forest, they are not very linked to internet, to social media, and so on. So people who are most suffering from forest fires, they are neglected, they are isolated, so it's very difficult to them to show this information. And also they are, of course, afraid of state, because it's very easy to be punished if you are living in small settlement for saying bad things about activity of local governments.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith from Moscow. My guest is Dr. Alexei Yaroshenko, the top forest campaigner for Greenpeace Russia. Here in Canada, we also have more and more fires in our boreal forests because those areas are so remote and with few settlements here, our government lets them burn as a natural force. The Russian government also doesn't fight such fires. What is the difference?
I think that difference is less and less with time. The major difference is now in accessibility of information. For example, in Canada, in US, we can watch the databases on fires to watch a real situation. So there is no intention to hide fires. There may be mistakes, but there is no intentional hiding of fires. In our country, we have false information on forest fires and even no intention from the governmental side to make this information real. This is maybe the major difference. I think that the problems that are related to climate change, they are very common to all countries with large forests.
Yes, it's happening in Alaska too. Alexei Yaroshenko, the Siberian Times quotes you saying, "The scale of the wildfires in eastern Siberia can be compared with the catastrophe of 2010 in European Russia and the Urals. I did a special report on those 2010 Russian wildfires. They were very frightening. And at the time, I interviewed Vladimir Chuprov from Greenpeace Russia." Why do you say this year's fires are even larger?
Because the area of forest fires is bigger now. For example, in 2010, the total area burned was about 5 million hectares. It was not the heaviest year in Russian forest fire history. Now we have at least 8 million hectares of forest fires, and I think that will be much more than 8 million. In 2010, fires happened in most populated areas of European Russia and Urals. So they were very visible. They make huge damage for settlements, for people's health, and so on. Now fires are burning in much less populated area, and they are not very visible for society. But the scale of fires is bigger, and amount of smoke is also bigger. And the loss of forest will be bigger than we had in 2010.
Greenpeace Russia continues to alert the international media to this problem. What do you want people to do?
First of all, we want to destroy the system of fire light, the system when the fires are hidden, and this allows government to do nothing with these fires, not to solve the problems that lead to these fires. This is one of the major tasks of our anti-fire work. And I think that more information about fires will help to achieve this task. The more opinion from people we will have to the forest fires, the easier it will be to destroy the system of light.
Now, once that is done and the government is more open about the fires that exist, what should the Russian government do? I mean, climate change is warming Russia faster than most other places on Earth.
Yes, that's true. And we are afraid that Siberia will be one of the regions most affected by climate change. There are some issues that can be resolved. For example, one of the major reasons of forest fire in Siberia is inaccurate prescribed burning, or grass burning. Not only prescribed, but grass burning by different people for different reasons. So we are fighting for many years to get the ban for any uncontrolled grass burning, and it gives some results. So we got this ban on paper in November last year. It already helped to decrease amount of fires in the first wave in spring, in April, May, and June. We have about one-third less fires than we have usually. So we need also to continue and to expand this ban to exclude massive grass burning from land use practices. Our estimation that it will decrease about twice the amount of fires and will make easier to fight with remaining, because amount of fires is one of the bigger problems. And second, we need to restore professional firefighting service that was destroyed 10 years ago by the new Russian forest code. The major thing that was done by this forest code is destruction of economic basis of the forest management. So before this forest code, since the very old times, Peter the Great, Tsar, it was 300 years ago, forestry developed in Russia as a normal economic branch of economy. So it had some own money that was earned from forest, and this money was spent for protection of forest for firefighting. Now, the new forest code broke this link, so now the firefighting system completely depends on the budget financing, and budget has no money for this work. So we need to restore the normally working forestry as a branch of economy.
As we finish up, is there anything else that you would like to tell our listeners?
Yes, I think too, that we should keep in mind that the problems that we have now, it's only a sign of the new problems that we will get sooner, that the climate is warming and we have to be very careful with forest and with fires, because we have every year more and more signs that climate change will destroy a lot of forests and increase a lot of problems.
From Moscow, we've been speaking with the top forest campaigner at Greenpeace Russia, Alexei Yaroshenko. Alexei, thank you so much for telling us about this news.
Yeah, thank you.
For Radio EcoShock, I'm Alex Smith. This is Radio EcoShock. Stay tuned for more on the climate crisis from Germany and America. Former NASA scientist James Hansen often speaks of global warming still in the pipeline. The actual contributions to atmospheric change have been masked by the dimming effect of other air pollution. Our next guest might call that a climate debt, except she has documented a different source of greenhouse gases that apparently cannot be stopped now. The press has labeled them zombie emissions. Stick with me, please. This is important. We're going to reach out to the lead author, Isabel Rosa. She has a PhD in computational ecology and works with the German Center for Integrative Biodiversity Research. From Leipzig, Germany, Isabel, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. Well, Alex, it's good to be here.
I realize this debt, as you call it, coming due involves more than climate change, but let's start with that. What is the source of the so-called zombie emissions you and your team published about last summer in the journal Current Biology?
Tropical forests have been under great pressure over the last few decades, and trees have been cut down at a really fast rate. When the trees are cut down, some of the wood is removed, some of it is burned, and some of it is left at the site to decay naturally as it decomposes. And so these emissions that were called zombie emissions by a journalist are actually these emissions that result from the decomposition of these wood or organic matter that is left on the site and it decomposes over time.
It's hard for people to picture. I've seen clear cuts in North America, and there are massive amounts of wood left. Even when they make some burning piles, there's just huge amounts of carbon left on the forest floor.
Yeah, it's so in the tropics, it's it depends a little bit on what the forest has been cut down for. So, for instance, maybe in the past, deforestation was more traditional or more small scale for slash and burn agriculture. But in more recent years, large scale agriculture with for mechanized agriculture remove much more wood from the sites than previous types of deforestation. But it, like you said, it's still a large amount of wood that is left to decompose and where the forest was standing before.
How can we understand the magnitude of carbon emissions due to be released by tropical deforestation? Do you have some numbers for us?
So our estimates show that if we don't do anything, and it's important to say that there are some ways in which we can help, not preventing, but at least capturing back some of these emissions. So we estimated that these emissions would be the same as stopping deforestation completely, and these emissions would correspond to having 5 to 10 more years of deforestation, which I think is significant if we think of how many forests are being cut down currently.
So even if we stop this relentless wave of cutting down tropical forests, the emissions pictured in your paper would still continue for perhaps a decade.
Yes, exactly. It's and that tells us how much we, as humans, have been having a strong impact on our planet and a long-lasting impact.
What methods did you use to calculate the amount of carbon in fallen trees and vegetation? I mean, you did it on an international scale. That's a big project.
Yes, indeed. And the project is based on computer simulations, not based on field data or field data collection. So we used maps that were developed by my co-author Matthew Smith from Microsoft Research Cambridge, where he estimated the potential carbon that was in those trees before they have been cut down. And then we superimposed our deforestation maps produced by my model to estimate how much carbon was lost over time.
But won't the trees grow back and suck up that carbon again?
Some of it, but the problem is a lot of these areas are actually being replaced by agricultural fields, which are not able to capture as much carbon as a tropical forest. It's a completely different ecosystem. And so I think it's important to understand that although some of the carbon can be recaptured, we really need to think of ways to accelerate or to allow for a greater recapture of the carbon by, for instance, incentivizing conservation and also restoration, particularly restoring degraded areas that aren't being used for agriculture for whichever reason. These should be areas where we should actively create an incentive for forest restoration.
Well, as we know, time after time, governments and even United Nations science reports underestimate the true amount of greenhouse gases reaching the atmosphere. They don't count aircraft emissions. They haven't counted some Arctic gases. To your knowledge, did the IPCC reports or the Paris Accord include the emissions from ruined forests?
To my knowledge, these emissions from the decay of the wood have not been taken into account, at least with the level of detail that we were able to do in our study.
So with the data from your paper, do we know enough now to add these future emissions to calculations of the global carbon budget?
There's still uncertainties that I think need to be addressed, and I think I try to focus a little bit on that on the study as well. because, for instance, we know now we're getting better and better at monitoring deforestation rates with better and better satellite data, but there's still large sources of uncertainty in terms of the amount of biomass that is actually in the forest. But I think I hope my study is it's a contribution towards improving our knowledge on the true contribution of deforestation and land cover change to climate change.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Dr. Isabel Rosa. She's the lead author of a new paper on the unexpected blowback from tropical deforestation. And Isabella, the other shocking surprise in your paper is that the process of forest breakdown will accelerate the disappearance of species from this planet. How is that possible?
So there are a lot of species that are forest dependent, so their preferred habitat for surviving it's forest, and we've been cutting this down so fast and the species cannot survive in whatever ecosystem replaces the forest. And so we've shown that with 60 years of tropical deforestation, we've lost already more than 40 species that we will not be able to replace. And if we do not act to restore this forest that we have destroyed, then we will lose an even higher number of species over the next few years as a result of all the deforestation in the past.
Why are these extinctions delayed, Isabella, when the forests have been cut down? Why don't the species die right away but appear years later?
There's called a relaxation period where species may try to adapt to the new environment, and so that's why there's not an immediate loss of the species, but over time, as species are not able to survive, they might go extinct.
So as you did your study, what countries had the greatest buildup of yet-to-be-released greenhouse gases and the greatest threat of loss of species? Where is the big tropical deforestation happening?
As it's well known, I believe Brazil had a very significant amount of deforestation, especially since the 70s until the early 2000s, with a recent slowdown. And overall, over the 60-year period, Brazil was definitely the country where we estimated a higher loss of carbon and a greater number of species extinctions. This was followed by Indonesia, and much less so in Congo, where deforestation is still very low, but it seems to be increasing, unfortunately.
You know, I've been wondering if this extra carbon enhances the trend of drying out trees in a hotter world. I mean, there's concern right now that millions of trees have died in the United States. Other scientists suggest some of the Amazon may convert to grasslands, partly due to climate change. Does that make these emissions, in a way, a positive feedback where deforestation may lead to more deforestation?
We didn't account for that, but it could be, yeah, because the tropics is it's a very large area in the globe, and it has been contributing a lot to the amount of carbon in the atmosphere, so it's not something that I have analyzed myself, but I believe that it could have an effect.
You know, it's interesting. Your paper really reaches out to two very distinct groups of activists. You have activists and scientists and policymakers who work on climate change and others who seem to work on forests and species extinction. Why do you think a single mechanism is leading to such diverse changes to both species and the atmosphere?
I think the overall glue, so to speak, is the vegetation and the habitat. So when you destroy such a biodiversity and biomass-rich ecosystem such as tropical forests and you replace it by an agricultural field, you have a very big impact not only on species but also on carbon cycle. And I think it's important to, in the future, to consider conservation and restoration actions that actually look at multiple angles and not only on one or the other.
I remember talking to one scientist, he was actually working in the boreal forest, who said, we might actually be better if we just buried the excess wood, because at least that would slow down and add carbon to the soil.
Yeah, that's a good point.
It would be a massive project, of course, and we could never do it. But
no.
So you've made kind of a prediction about continuing emissions in this paper. Is there a way to test that, or does it need testing?
Continuing emissions from active deforestation, you mean?
Yes.
Unfortunately, I think it's a clear pattern, at least for now. And although in Brazil there was a slowdown in deforestation rates, we could see an acceleration of these rates in the Congo and also to some extent in Southeast Asia. So we live in a world where human population is still growing, and we are very demanding and high consuming humans. So we need to be able to produce food to feed all these people. So there's still incentive to the agricultural business, and unfortunately, the more production has been coming not from intensifying existing agricultural fields, but coming from destroying natural habitats and particularly destroying tropical forests. And I think we need a bigger effort as a community to prevent future tropical deforestation.
Well, I completely agree. But as we wrap up, I want to ask you on a personal note, what is computational ecology?
A fancy name for an ecologist that works essentially with behind a computer and on a desk and does a lot of modeling and not so much field work as that, like she wishes.
So what are you working on now or next?
So my research interests are based on how we can use land cover change scenarios to inform policy and decision making. So at the moment, I'm studying how we can use these scenarios to help implementing, for instance, payments for ecosystem services policy that would allow us to create incentives for forest restoration, for example, particularly in the Atlantic forest in Brazil, or how we can use scenarios of future land cover change to inform decision makers on the impacts of building new infrastructures. And I'm doing that for the Serengeti National Park.
Those are also big projects, and I look forward to your research. We've been talking with Dr. Isabel Rosa from the German Center for Integrative Biodiversity Research in Leipzig. She's the lead author of one of the more important publications of the summer of 2016, I think. The title is The Environmental Legacy of Modern Tropical Deforestation, as published in the journal Current Biology. You can find links to Isabel and the paper in my Radio EcoShock blog, published every Wednesday at ecoshock.info. Isabel, thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
Thank you so much, Alex. It was a pleasure talking to you.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Right now, this year and every year, giant oil, gas, and coal multinationals and nationalized fossil fuel countries are spending a large part of their income trying to find new fields, more wells, and new mines. They are pushing national governments to support or even fund more pipelines, train lines, ports, and infrastructure. You know, you're seeing it in the news all around you. They want to make more carbon power happen. Media is carefully crafted to make us fearful of a change, to make us support more subsidies and cheap permissions. A powerful new report details why the atmosphere cannot withstand any more exploration and development by the fossil fuel industry or the national states. But even this information, startling as it may be for the public and investors, doesn't go far enough to avoid a climate catastrophe. After the interview, I'll explain why.
Radio EcoShock.
How much greenhouse gas will come from our existing energy system as it is with no further exploration or development? Those numbers, believe it or not, are hard to get. A group called Oil Change International found the figures, and they've released them in a free report. The title is The Sky's the Limit: Why the Paris Climate Goals Require a Managed Decline of Fossil Fuel Production. To talk about all this, we've reached David Turnbull. He's the campaigns director of Oil Change International and a contributor to this new report. David, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks so much for having me.
You know, right now in the United States, Native Americans are trying to stop the Dakota Access Pipeline construction. And at the same time, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau must decide whether to allow a pipeline expansion from the tar sands to Vancouver Harbor. What does your report say about new pipeline construction?
Our report comes to a pretty clear conclusion, which is that any new fossil fuel infrastructure that will incentivize new development is off limits if we want to actually achieve the goals that we've set forward when it comes to the climate. So those pipelines, the Dakota Access Pipeline in North Dakota, the Kinder Morgan Pipeline in Canada, and any pipelines really that will actually incentivize new fossil fuel development need to be off the table.
People are fighting wars right now in the Middle East with the hopes of building new pipelines from Qatar and through Turkey and all sorts of things. So this has geopolitical implications as well as climate implications.
That's absolutely right. And of course, climate change itself has huge geopolitical implications. We're seeing major conflicts being arisen because of the impacts of climate change in Africa and elsewhere, where resource wars and concerns and issues arising from droughts and other climate impacts are so impactful on geopolitics. This report, it is incredibly important for geopolitics because of the power of the fossil fuel industry around the world. What we're saying is that they need to stop digging new mines, new wells, and we need our government to take action to make sure that's the case. It's a big result, but it's also backed by science, and it's something that we have to achieve.
Well, we'll get into how you did the report, but meanwhile, I have to say the fossil fuel industry spends billions and billions looking for new sources of oil and gas. It's part of their game. It's how they keep their share prices up, depending on claiming those new reserves. How can they keep share prices up and their business going if they just stop exploring for more?
It's a good question, and it actually points to a problem that we have with the way that fossil fuel industries are valued by investors and Wall Street. As you say, they need to keep finding new fossil fuels if they want to keep their stock price high. But what we now know is that finding those new fossil fuels is really anathema to taking action on climate change. So we need to figure out a way for governments to pursue a managed decline of the fossil fuel industry, where we move away from fossil fuels quickly.
And what about countries which are still heavily reliant on coal? I'm thinking of India and China. What does this report say to them?
Well, there's a really important point around India in particular, which is that, you know, some of these countries have not really been a huge part of the problem of climate change historically. Of course, now we see emissions rising around the world, but the historic nature of climate change is such that a country like India has not contributed nearly as much to the problem as the United States or other rich countries. So what we're seeing and what a lot of people are calling for is for rich countries to help ensure that there's support that is needed to help poorer countries around the world, particularly like in Africa, to ensure that they are able to move beyond fossil fuels to help bring energy access to their poor communities, but do it in a way that skips over fossil fuels and goes straight to renewable energy. And they need support from rich countries like the United States and in Europe to help make that a reality.
You know, I've interviewed hundreds of scientists now at this point, and I've developed this gut feeling personally that if we want to keep the climate we evolved with, we can't burn any more fossil fuels. But David Turnbull, your group's report isn't really saying that. It isn't saying stop burning today, is it?
That's right. We're not saying that we need to turn off the taps overnight. We recognize that we need to have a rapid transition away from fossil fuels. That means both rapid, we need to do it quickly, but it is a transition. we need to recognize that we can't shift to renewable energy completely overnight, but we need to do so quickly. And our analysis shows that the current mines, the current wells of fossil fuels around the world are enough to bring us to the brink of climate chaos. So we certainly need to stop digging new mines and wells, and we need to find a way to actually close some of those existing mines early and transition to renewables as quickly as possible.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. I mean, according to the calculations in this report, we can't even allow the existing oil and gas fields or the coal mines to pump out all they've got before they close them. Is that correct?
That's correct. We've looked at two different temperature goals when we're making our analysis. So the first is a 2 degrees above pre-industrial levels of warming. That's a goal that's been agreed for a number of years by global governments around the world. And it's one that a lot of people say is the maximum that we can see if we want to achieve climate safety. But there's a second goal, which is 1.5 degrees. That's half a degree less of warming. And recently, there's been a lot of discussion about that actually being the safest level of warming that we can withstand, or the highest level of warming that we can withstand. So what we've seen in our analysis is that if we want to achieve 1.5 degrees of warming or less, we can't burn all of the fossil fuels that are in the existing fossil fuel development projects. And even if we were to shut off coal immediately, the oil and gas and the wells that are already dug could also bring us past that 1.5 degree goal. So the short story is, yes, we may have to look at shutting down some of those mines and wells before their lifespan is complete. And that's going to be a really challenging thing to do, but it's something that the science is pointing towards.
I guess all of us are wondering, myself and our listeners, what international or national laws could possibly limit the production of these mega corporations and their ability to bribe and fund political elections? Can anybody really stop them from producing as much as they can sell?
That's a good question. I mean, I think that we're seeing a global movement already developing to keep fossil fuels in the ground, standing up to basically every single major fossil fuel infrastructure project in the North American continent, let alone across the world. So, you know, there's communities that are standing up in amazing ways to stop new fossil fuel development. If you coupled that with real, strong, serious government action to limit fossil fuel production on federal lands, to stop fossil fuel subsidies, we're talking about billions of dollars each year of government money going to support fossil fuel development. If you saw strong government action that really sort of came on the heels of this amazing community action, yeah, we could stand up to the industry and turn them around.
So, David, why is it so difficult to find out the amount of greenhouse gases our current fossil fuel infrastructure is producing?
Well, you know, the information's out there, but it's really dispersed. You have to compile all of these different companies of annual reports and reporting to the governments and such. And so we've worked by looking at a database, an industry database, not a lot of nonprofits actually have access to, but we've gained access to it, and we're using it to look at these reserves and really get a full, complete picture and understanding.
Who put up the money to get what you needed for the report?
We're funded by a number of different foundations that are concerned about addressing climate change, as well as individual donors or supporters around the country. And yeah, it's a decent investment. But, you know, we like to think that at Oil Change International, we're helping to democratize that data. We're helping to bring it to the public forum and ensure that everyone that needs to be aware of what's really going on in the fossil fuel industry is aware of that.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. My name is Alex Smith, and my guest is David Turnbull, the campaign director for the nonprofit group Oil Change International. We're looking at their new report, which says if we want to avoid a catastrophic climate shift, the days of exploring for more oil and gas and coal, or building new pipelines and ports, those days are over. Well, David, some of the Middle Eastern countries routinely hide or misreport their oil and gas assets. How does anybody know how big their reserves are?
You know, there's a bit of a combination of geology, just simply having a scientific understanding of what those formations actually look like, and, you know, some investigative sort of analysis. The people behind the fossil fuel industry database that we've been working with, you know, they're experts. They spend night and day looking at this stuff, and they make what may actually be conservative estimates of what's out there. And whether we're off by a small amount here or there, we don't think we are, but the scale of the problem is so abundantly clear that the misreporting or potential, you know, differences in specific numbers doesn't change the actual conclusion, which is that we know we have far too many fossil fuels out there, and our existing fossil fuel development will bring us past what we want to achieve in terms of climate safety.
Well, Bill McKibben of 350.org has written about the terrible new math, and he quotes this report. What sort of numbers are in this report?
So some of the numbers that Bill cites, which are sort of at the heart of our analysis, is that scientists, climate scientists, have said if we want to have a two-thirds chance of staying below those 2 degrees of Celsius of global warming, we can release 800 gigatons more CO2 into the atmosphere. But what our data shows, or the data that we've accessed and analyzed shows, is that current coal mines, oil and gas wells, and fossil fuel development currently operation have 942 gigatons worth of CO2 embedded in them. So as Bill says, the math problem is quite simple. 942 gigatons is far bigger than 800 gigatons, which climate scientists say is the safe amount. And so that's our problem. If you want to look even further at the 1.5 degree goal, which many around the world, including all global leaders, actually have signed up to, aspiring to stay close to, that 800 gigatons actually goes down to 353 gigatons of CO2 being the safe amount that we can emit moving forward. So again, 942 gigatons worth of CO2 in the fossil fuel development projects around the world, and only 353 gigatons of that is actually safe if we want to hit our 1.5 degree global warming target.
Well, you know, that's interesting because the SEC, the organization in charge of the American Stock Exchange, are investigating Exxon's reporting of their assets, but they're doing it because the price of oil has fallen so much and Exxon still has it marked very high on their books. But there may be another reason to investigate those assets if the figures in your report are true, because they just won't be able to burn perhaps only a third of what they claim.
That's right. You know, we think that new fossil fuel development is a terrible investment, and we're seeing that shift amongst a number of financial experts and institutional investors. That's a large part of the global fossil fuel divestment movement, is not only a moral question of whether we should be investing our money and our retirement funds and other finances in these companies that are bringing about climate chaos, but also, frankly, is it actually a good investment? And more, that question is a serious one, and it's one that a lot of investors are answering with a no. This isn't a good investment because some of these fossil fuels are going to stay in the ground, because we know that our governments are going to take strong action to address climate change, because the world is so calling and demanding for that action to take place. So, you know, the SEC investigation of Exxon is a really interesting moment. It's a really interesting initiative by SEC to really question this accounting practice of Exxon, but also more broadly for the oil and fossil fuel industry writ large. There's a question of whether these assets that they're spending a lot of money and investment to find and to put onto their books are actually worth much because of that fact that we're going to need to keep them in the ground.
So, David Turnbull, what kind of decline do we need? How much and how fast? Do we know that yet?
Well, we know we need to be off fossil fuels in the next couple decades, really. If you want to achieve 1.5 degrees of warming, of staying below 1.5 degrees of warming, we're talking about moving off of fossil fuels completely in a very short while. If you're talking about 2 degrees of warming, you might have until the middle of the century, but that's being a little bit, that's giving some leeway. But we're really talking about a couple decades here to really take a serious global action to move away from fossil fuels. So time is short. And we're not saying turn off the taps for fossil fuels overnight, but we're saying we need to move quickly and really, really strongly away from fossil fuels. And that's why we subtitled this report talking about the need for a managed decline of the fossil fuel industry. We need our governments to take action, to work with the industry to move away from fossil fuels. And if we take that initiative now, we can do so in a way that allows for renewable energy to rise up and replace the fossil fuel industry in an organized fashion. If we wait a decade or longer, it's going to be a much more disruptive situation if we actually want to take the necessary action. Taking it now is a manageable situation. Taking it later is a much more difficult prospect.
Realistically, do we know whether alternative energy sources can be scaled up and built quickly enough to stay at 2 degrees C global mean heating or below?
The good news is that we do think that it's the case that we can scale up renewable energy in time. Our report, The Sky's Limit, references a number of different studies from Stanford professors and other academics that lay out plans to achieve 100% renewable energy in the time that we need to in order to achieve our climate goals. It can do so in a way that also presents a just transition for the workers in the fossil fuel industry so that they can be retrained, they can have assistance programs to ensure that they're taken along in this transition and not left behind. But the good news of this report, if they're, you know, amidst all of the scary news, is that we can do it. That the analysis is there. The renewable energy industry is booming. Solar, wind, geothermal, all of these energy renewable energy technologies are becoming far cheaper and far more available, and that's exactly what we need.
Before this report, I have to admit I hadn't heard of Oil Change International. Where did this group come from?
We're just over a decade old, and we come from a number of different individuals. Our founder, Steve Kretzman, has been working on campaigns to move away from oil for a couple of decades, 25 years even, and we're full of campaigners and researchers who have been working on this issue for years. And we're really focused on ensuring that we are exposing the true costs of fossil fuels for our climate, for our communities, so that we can break down the barriers to a clean energy transition. So we put out reports like The Sky's Limit and other reports to expose what the real problem is, what the real problems with different pipeline proposals are, and those sorts of issues that are in the forefront of our politics. And we campaign hard with our supporters to push against these ill-sought proposals.
How can our listeners help get this report out there and working?
So we encourage everyone to go to priceofoil.org, which is our website, and read the report. Call your decision makers, call your legislators, your congresspeople, tell them about it, tell your friends about it, and just do whatever you can to organize in your communities against fossil fuel projects. There are so many out there, and there are so many amazing community uprisings and resistance, and I couldn't encourage you more to join in.
Can you give us any hints about the next project Oil Change International will be working on?
Well, we're going to be working on really trying to implement what the logical conclusion of this report is, which is no new fossil fuel development. So we're working to try to make sure that our U.S. government is planning for that scenario, and that includes developing energy models that can look at what our fossil fuel use looks like if we are actually achieving our climate goals, and then basing decision-making off of that kind of a model. What we've seen is that we need to stop fossil fuel development. We want the government to take that on board as they consider new energy policy. So we're going to be working towards that so-called climate test, pushing that forward in our decision-making so that our government can plan for success in achieving our climate goals rather than plan for failure.
I'm Alex Smith, talking with David Turnbull. He's the campaigns director of Oil Change International and a contributor to the report titled The Sky's the Limit. You'll find links to all this in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info or go directly to the website priceofoil.org. David, thank you so much for your work and for talking with us today on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Alex Smith reporting. In the news, there was just a major storm in Australia. On September 28th, a large part of South Australia lost electric power. The grid went down as hurricane-force winds blew over and destroyed large transmission towers. The Australian government, generally supported by the media monopoly owned by climate opponent Rupert Murdoch, turned this into an opportunity to question any move towards alternative energy. The state power operator said the source of electricity had nothing to do with it. It doesn't matter if you have solar power holding up those transmission towers against the wind or coal power. But the storm became a political club in the hands of the federal conservative government, which is pushing for gigantic new coal mines and a matching super coal port on the edge of the Great Barrier Reef. Here in Canada, one media company, Global Television, owned by Shaw Media, ran story after story about the poor rural customers paying too much for electricity. And that was because of green power, don't you see? That eventually whipped up enough public pressure that the government again blamed the green energy industry. The Ontario government promised to scale back wind and solar. The media chain sounded almost hopeful this would spread to the rest of Canada. A pullback from solar would benefit the beleaguered tar sands in Alberta and supposedly help the Canadian economy. Just one more example. The financial editor of Britain's Telegraph newspaper is Ambrose Evans-Pritchard. Ambrose can be very insightful. I read him. He's biased against Europe, sure. He's written often about the promise of alternative energy. And yet Evans-Pritchard can write an article totally hopeful about the return of higher oil prices and talking about rebuilding the fossil fuel industry as a good and necessary thing. Time and time again, the mainstream media willfully ignores the huge risk of such fossil fantasies. Time and again, they represent the powerful status quo of fossil fuel dominance in the world economy and our lives. Watch out for those stories that tell you solar or wind power is dangerous somehow, that it isn't real, that it can't power our lives. Quickly ask yourself, on every occasion, why are they telling you that? Who do they represent? But I have to say, now and again, even activists who have a good track record of fighting climate action, as David Turnbull certainly has, may not be able to face or focus on the awful truth of our situation. Or perhaps they can only tell us what we fossil-crazed public can tolerate right now. In this interview, David Turnbull says if we want to stay at or below 1.5 degrees C global warming, we may have a couple of decades to keep burning fossil fuels while we make a transition. I doubt that. Dr. Watson says we have already passed the 1.5 degree mark. Dr. James Hansen and others say using the global mean temperature measurement is dangerous in itself. And the reasons for that are a bit complicated. They involve our understanding of how sensitive the climate is, a belated comprehension of the role of warming of the oceans, and many risks not covered by straight temperature change. I mean, look at severe storms or the oceans turning more acidic. That just isn't covered by temperature. It doesn't tell the whole story. So I disagree that we have anything like two decades left to burn fossil fuels. Instead, we need emergency action, including planned power reductions, or even rolling cuts if we have to, coupled with huge government financing to swing over to a combination of massively reduced energy use and very localized direct power by solar, wind, geothermal, or if we have to, hydropower. We may only have 5 years to save ourselves and protect our descendants from the worst. And that is why I support the call for planetary emergency action to save the climate. It's not a radical call. In fact, it's pretty well too late. It's a last-ditch call for sanity in the face of a super threat. There isn't time in this program to tell you much about the new Climate Chance campaign. A multifaceted group of experts, coordinated at this time, it seems, by the Landscape Architecture Foundation, is applying for a $100 million grant to develop an emergency action plan. The goal is to stave off the worst of climate change, to give ourselves and our descendants a chance. I'm looking into how I can help this appeal, perhaps by connecting the many famous scientists and authors that have been on the show. We'll see. You can get more details in the show blog for this week of October 5, 2016, published at ecoshock.info. And I'm just one person, so there's only so much I'll be able to do, but Maybe you can see a way to fit climate action into your life. Can you talk it up and lead by example? Can we all do it, by the millions, until we find a way out of this carbon trap? Thank you for listening to Radio EcoShock. I know it's a big investment of your time in these days of 140-character news bites and swirling headlines. It's my goal to help you tune into life-saving information as quickly and as powerfully as I can, directly from the source. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
TTIP finish? Is it dead in the water?
Well, it certainly looks that way. I mean, what with the two major players, the French and the Germans, saying they think that that's it, that does seem pretty clear. It's also, the timing is interesting because after the Brexit vote and the signal that maybe next year Article 50 will be triggered and Britain will begin its process of leaving the European Union. Britain was one of the enthusiasts for TTIP, and it looks to me as if, you know, in many ways, the French and the German are pleased to see the back of the Brits, and they're saying, well, actually, this agreement wasn't for us. And there are very good reasons why they would say that, because, you know, the Brussels itself is very, very much behind this. But I think it's fair to say the individual member states don't want anything to do with it, because effectively it means their own abolition. This is agreement which would give big corporations, many of which share different both sides of the transatlantic bridge, gives them the power to sue governments through the particular part of the agreement, which is, you know, this part of this TTIP.
Okay, so it looks pretty certain now that TTIP has actually, incredibly, actually come to an end. It's amazing, isn't it? We should be celebrating. But before we do go out on the street and dance, we should perhaps look more closely at the international situation, because there are other little things going on. There are other huge, in fact, transatlantic trade agreement negotiations taking place right now. One of them is called CETA, which is basically, it's called Comprehensive Economic and Trade Agreement between Canada and the EU. And the other one is called TISA, which is short for Trade in Services Agreement. Now, let's start talking about CETA, first of all. Do you know anything about this, Tony?
Yes. Well, I mean, like you, it's just, this is something that I've come across often through small campaign groups like New Economics Foundation doing the digging. Because mm-hmm. the thing that is, unifies all these agreements, I'm sure Oliver would agree with me here, is they're all shrouded in secrecy. The idea is that because we have voted for various people, some of those people are European commissioners, actually, who we've never voted for. They seem to think that they have the executive authority and power to go and negotiate these things for us in secret without telling us what's going on. CETA is effectively a kind of TTIP for TTIP is between the United States and the EU. CETA is an equivalent between Canada and the EU. It's also being negotiated behind the scenes. And you mentioned the Trade in Services Agreement, TISA. Now, that is a global equivalent to this, and it's also being negotiated in total secret. So we really do have to ask questions about what is part of these.
Okay, let's just stick to CETA at the moment. Now, how far have negotiations gone? I mean, has the EU signed up for CETA or not?
No, not yet, but there are negotiations going on. The thing is, it's actually very difficult to find out how far the negotiations have gone. So it's a little bit like the various kinds of, I mean, say, for example, you've got a big IT contract going on, been signed, say, for the National Health Service here in Britain, for example. It's almost impossible to get progress reports on how that contract is going. And that's one of the main reasons cited for these contracts going to massive billions sometimes of money wasted, because the government doesn't want to admit when things aren't going well. They're really just trying to contain a PR situation rather than do any kind of honest negotiation. And the big common thread between all these agreements cannot be stressed enough. It's called the Investor State Dispute Settlement, ISDS, which has been looked into just over the last week or so very carefully by Tambi at BuzzFeed News. He's done a fantastic job. Really, really big pat on the back to him. I'm not sure if Oliver's seen these reports. One of them is called The Court That Rules the World. This is all about this ISDS. And he's explaining that the way these secret tribunals have worked out in various cases, often in developing world countries up till now, which show where this is all heading. And it's to do with a big corporate takeover, effectively banishing our democratic government.
Okay, but I still don't understand why that means that it's a threat to democracy. Tony, can you come in here, please?
Yeah, it's a really, really simple. As I said, the BuzzFeed article, these investigations on BuzzFeed have done a really good job in going into this. Effectively, what it does, it allows the corporations to sue governments that pass laws that affect their profits, but it doesn't allow governments to sue corporations. So it's a one-way street agreement. What it effectively means is that corporate lawyers, not our MPs and our elected representatives in our legislatures, will be writing laws in the future. And I also want to point out about CETA that this is being affected badly by what's happened now with TTIP. So it looks as if this CETA deal will not be ratified. So I think this partly Brexit, the Brits moving out of the scene in the European Union, who were so much for TTIP, has almost been like a house of cards. These trade deals are starting to falter and collapse.
You can't just expect a country like China to trade with us if we don't offer China something. For example, if we don't offer Chinese nationals visas to live in countries, or we don't recognize their professional qualifications. Why should China trade with us or not with another country? I mean, you have to give and take. And services, service industry is different from goods, physical goods. It's something that you build, you get by building trust with other countries and so on. To expect other countries to trade with us without us giving anything in a way, isn't that being a bit kind of, you know, a bit unrealistic?
Two examples of things that would change. For example, it would enable US corporations to take over National Health Service contracts. And also, it would there's a little known food regulation, which is to do with irradiation of food, which is allowed in the United States without labeling. That could then be brought into Europe under this agreement. And people just simply don't want their food irradiated. It's just about extending the shelf life, and it's not about people's health.
They're not having that. So what you're saying is that everybody's possible potential partner for TISA, apart from Russia and China, is that right?
Well, they're happy to trade, the Chinese, for example. They're happy to trade with us. But what they're not happy is for this race to the bottom in regulation. And that's what these trade agreements represent. This is why the Chinese refuse to even get involved in the TISA, and the Russians have too, because they are not going to have US corporations trying to regulate their markets. And that's what this is really all about, I think, is they're not really interested in trade. Free trade is pretty much happening anyway. What they want is they want to control the regulation. And that effectively means a bit like with the banks, you know, the regulators controlling their own regulation. And that what that means, well, we know what that means, is a total disaster. It means that you've got a kind of corporate takeover, what they call in economic circles and in academia, regulatory capture. So where the big corporations don't have to actually be regulated at all. They control their own regulations. And of course, the Chinese and the Russians are not having that.
I'd like to change the subject slightly and come back to the UK. Now, before Brexit, basically, we thought that leaving the EU would mean bye-bye to TTIP, didn't we, in the UK? But I think a lot of us who voted to leave have forgot that actually the UK was, as Tony said earlier on, one of the key supporters of TTIP. And how on earth did we manage to convince ourselves that Brexited UK would then leave TTIP? Quite the opposite. surely the UK suffering economically, hungry for deals, is more likely to come to an arrangement with the United States.
Well, look, General de Gaulle saw Britain as the unsinkable aircraft carrier of the United States in Europe, and that's one of the reasons he didn't want Britain to be part of the European Union, or as it was the common market all those years ago. And in many ways, he's right. The American influence in Britain is tremendous, particularly with the Cameron government. We're still to see just how much Theresa May's government's going to be doing that. But look, let's just look for a minute at this new department that's been created by Theresa May, with Liam Fox as new Secretary of State in charge of it, the International Trade Department for International Trade. I mean, Fox has got a terrible track record, having brought this guy, Adam Werety, back in 2011. He was sacked because he brought this guy into the Ministry of Defence, many believe to have been working for the Israelis, right into the middle of the heart of the British defence establishment, and he was removed as a result. The allegation was that Werety was actually trying to cook up a war with the Iranians. You know, so this is not the guy to be putting in charge of and to trust with all this, I think. But Fox is very right-wing. I think he's going to go completely against the wishes of the British people and try and ram this TTIP through, realising that the Germans and the French are not on his back anymore.
OK, it's a win-win situation, isn't it, for the States? Because the UK out of the EU means it's more likely to join a TTIP-type organisation because it doesn't have the EU to stop it joining, right? And if it was to remain in, it would be useful to try to persuade the whole of the EU to join. Tony, do you agree with me?
Well, it's quite possible. And also, of course, they're looking at TISA. Maybe the EU will sign TISA. Maybe the Brits will sign something which is more akin to TTIP. You know, so I think that's a really important way of looking at this, is that it may be that they're kind of running these TISA agreements in the knowledge and understanding that that's going to be what they're going to get in the end. But look, let's take a step back for a minute, because what's being created here with these various trade agreements, it's not just free trade. It's to do with controlling the regulation of industry and banking, etc., through government. And these corporations effectively are setting up a kind of feudal system where chief executives of the banks, the media, big pharmaceutical companies and food giants are the new feudal barons. And what they're doing is they're using this investor-state district dispute procedure to give themselves, that is executives of these big firms, these big banks, get outs from the law. So say, for example, a big bank like HSBC is caught doing money laundering, the executives will be protected and only a few rogue traders may be prosecuted, and they'll get a fine, which is a piffling fine compared to the amount of money they made through money laundering. So this is the world we're going into. It's a kind of medieval feudal world with these big media barons, and you know, they're the most worrying in a way, running the whole show.
Yes, it's interesting, isn't it, that the so-called democratic countries of the world are sort of, in a way, less democratic in terms of trade than the so-called non-democratic countries. It's a bit of a mix-up, isn't it, Tony?
It certainly is. It's contradictory. And I think that there is a certain amount of free speech allowed, of course. But then you have to look at the media, big media corporations and their involvement with these big trade agreements, which they have been pushing for, most of them, because they stand to benefit. You know, they can then start regulating their own industry, which is what they love to do, of course. They don't really want ordinary people or victims, survivors, if you can call them that, of media, bad media coverage to be involved in any kind of regulation. So there is a certain amount of free speech. As that's happening, also, the media is being focused into fewer and fewer hands, fewer and fewer voices all the time. And most of them, of course, are pointing their fingers, for example, at wars like the Syria war, which they want to talk about, not at things like Yemen, which is far where they're far more culpable. I mean, for example, the British arms industry supplying massive amounts of bombs that are killing children, bombing hospitals, schools and that sort of thing. They don't want to talk about that kind of war. So the media is a big part of this, and they're big corporations with an interest in all this too.
To apologize in advance, but I'm back on the topic of cops shooting black people. It feels like deja vu all over again, and again, and again. This situation really sucks, like being totally helpless as we watch people strapped in like crash dummies and then slammed into the bricks over and over and over. And there's nothing that any of us can say or do to stop it. It's just an ongoing atrocity, a mass grave filled in installments. And yet there's constant backlash, a barrage of denunciations from all corners every time somebody suggests that possibly, just possibly, anti-cop violence might be the answer. In conversations on this topic in the mainstream media, I hear thoughtless platitudes and silly sound bites asserting that two wrongs don't make a right and that violence discredits protesters. What planet are we on? Sometimes two wrongs do make a right. If someone steals my car and I steal it back, two wrongs have made a right. But beyond that, I don't need the jerk who stole my car hiding behind some inapplicable moral posturing in order to continue screwing me. As for violence discrediting protesters, that kind of reasoning says that a rape victim struggling against a rapist is somehow discredited by recourse to violence. Nonsense. And to anyone offended by my analogy, I would like to quote one of my personal heroes, Ward Churchill, the smartest specimen currently on 2 feet, when he equated rape to colonization. He said, "If rape is violence, as feminists correctly insist, then so too is the interculture analog of rape, colonial domination." Now, in our current reality, I think it's a no-brainer that blacks are subjected to colonial domination, the interculture analog of rape, and cops are the sex organ of the colonial dominator. So let's do a quick exercise. Let's depersonalize the situation and analyze it objectively. We won't talk about cops and black people. We'll talk about Group C and Group B. In our analogy, Group C, over the course of decades, is involved in butchering Group B. Group B objects, but Group C always has an excuse, blaming the victims of Group B for their own deaths. But recently, video demonstrates that Group C really butchers Group B, and that Group C routinely lies about it. The general public concludes we need a national dialogue that never happens. Group C continues butchering Group B. Group B holds hands and sings Kumbaya. Group B seeks nonviolent solutions. Group C continues butchering Group B. Group B and co-conspirators burn down a convenience store and tip over Group C's cars. The public calls on legislation to make Group C wear body cameras. And public consensus is that Group B's violence is not the solution. Group C continues butchering Group B. Finally, after a death toll of thousands and a high-profile situation, a sniper from Group B shoots and kills 5 members of Group C. Again, the public condemns violence. For a short time, Group C suspends its butchery of Group B, but just for a short time. Then the butchery continues, and the general public throws up its hands, totally befuddled as to what could possibly save Group B from the genocide committed by Group C. But the general public is convinced with unyielding certitude that violence is not the answer for Group B. Do you see what I'm getting at here? It's clearly a pathology in thinking, a kind of mental illness to think of Group C, cops, and their violence as something other than violence. Cops killing black people is violence. It's also a clear pathology in thinking, a kind of mental illness to continue viewing this deplorable situation as something it is not. Not only is anti-cop violence the solution, but it is provably the solution. Anti-cop violence in Dallas resulted in a temporary moratorium on the genocide cops commit against black people. Very possibly, in killing 5 cops, that sniper in Dallas saved dozens or even hundreds of black lives. It is a pathology, a mentally ill message, to continue falsely harping that violence is not the answer, when it is. Anyone saying violence is not the answer is either a liar, an idiot, or a whack job. I'm not voicing an opinion here. I'm saying that objectively, to really save black lives, the solution is anti-cop violence. Shooting cops is provably the only way to get the cops to stop shooting black people. Period. No justice, no peace. F*** the police. Rebels in Charlotte Rock. This is anarchist prisoner Sean Swain for Warren Correctional in Lebanon, Ohio. If you're listening, you are the resistance.
You can write to Sean Swain at Sean Swain, 243
TTIP-205, Warren CI, P.O. Box 120, 5787 State Route 63, Lebanon, Ohio, 45036. For updates on his situation, his bid for U.S. President in 2016, and more writings by Sean can be found at seanswain.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Chris Nestrick of Christian Peacemaker Teams, who discusses some of the reasons why a slim majority of Colombian voters rejected a proposed peace agreement with leftist guerrillas that would have ended 52 years of war. Mary Catherine Nagel, an attorney and playwright, who explains why she believes the organized resistance challenging the Dakota Access Pipeline is part of a larger struggle to protect indigenous rights. And Adele Stan, senior Washington editor with Alternet.org, who examines the right-wing views of Libertarian presidential candidate Gary Johnson and the source of his funding. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Amnesty International claims Sudan has used chemical weapons against civilians in rebel-held areas of Darfur, the western province in the East African nation that has endured 13 years of deadly conflict. Human rights monitors cited satellite images and hundreds of interviews and concluded Sudan did use chemical weapons during its current offensive. The conflict in Darfur began in 2003 as ethnic clans rebelled against the Sudanese government. Reports quickly surfaced of brutal attacks on villagers by pro-government militias called the Janjaweed. In 2004, the United Nations adopted an arms embargo against militias and government troops in Sudan. The International Criminal Court has twice issued arrest warrants for Sudan's president Omar Hassan al-Bashir, who is accused of committing crimes against humanity and war crimes against the people of Darfur. Amnesty International estimates between 200 and 250 people have died since January from exposure to chemical weapon agents, including sulfur mustard and nitrogen mustard. Witnesses claim they observed chemical weapons were being dropped out of cargo planes, targeting areas where rebels were not present. Sudan, which denies using chemical weapons, is a signatory to the 1993 Chemical Weapons Convention, which declares their use a war crime. For 2 years, the United States and Russia effectively worked on controlling nuclear weapons and established an aid supply route for U.S. and NATO forces in Afghanistan. Yet U.S.-Russian relations crumbled in 2011 after a U.S.-led military coalition intervened in Libya in order to oust dictator Muammar Gaddafi. In Clinton's 2014 book titled Hard Choices, the former Secretary of State warned, "Don't flatter Putin with high-level attention. Strength and resolve were the only language Putin would understand." President Obama canceled a summit meeting with Russia after Putin granted asylum to NSA surveillance whistleblower Edward Snowden. But the Obama White House rejected Clinton's advice to take a more aggressive approach in Syria. During the Democratic presidential primary campaign last October, Clinton called for a no-fly zone over Syria, a position supported by many Republican war hawks. However, in recent congressional testimony, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Joseph Dunford, noted, "For now, for us to control all airspace in Syria would require us to go to war with both Syria and Russia." In the 2016 election campaign, the Asian American vote is gaining considerable attention, and activists are working harder to boost voter turnout in Asian communities where talk about politics is often discouraged. In 2012, President Obama won over 70% of the Asian American Pacific Islander vote, yet only 48% of Asian Americans voted that year. In 2010, with the emergence of the right-wing Tea Party movement, one-third of Asian Americans told pollsters they were too busy to vote. During the recent presidential primary campaign, two-thirds of Asian American voters said they were not contacted by Democratic or Republican campaigns, and many are first-generation immigrants and have trouble obtaining ballots translated into their native Asian languages. Many Asian Americans, especially the older generation, avoid talking about politics or engaging with socioeconomic issues. That apolitical culture was instilled in part from the persecution political dissidents suffered in many of the nation's Asian families left behind. However, young Asian Americans are now sounding off on the need to become engaged and using the ballot to pressure elected officials to listen to their community's concerns and priorities. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
Although many polls conducted in recent weeks indicated that supporters of a proposed peace agreement between the Colombian government and the FARC guerrilla group would easily win the October 2nd national referendum, the deal was narrowly defeated. Complacency among the accord supporters, combined with hurricane-force winds that buffeted Colombia's coast on Election Day, contributed to a low voter turnout of less than 38%. Former Colombian President Alvaro Uribe, who campaigned to defeat the pact that was negotiated over 4 years, charged that too many concessions had been made to the guerrillas, including the offer of amnesty for war crimes committed by rebel fighters during 52 years of war. For their part, FARC's leadership maintained that they too had made concessions, such as dropping demands for radical land and economic reforms. Colombian President Juan Manuel Santos, who had negotiated the peace deal, said that the rebels and government will maintain the year-long ceasefire while negotiators from all sides of the conflict convene to salvage the chance for peace in a war that has killed an estimated 250,000 and displaced more than 6 million people. Your reporter spoke with Chris Nestrick, a project support coordinator with Christian Peacemakers Colombia team, who discusses some of the reasons why voters may have rejected the peace accord and his hope that a path to lasting peace will be found.
What we do know, and which is really important, is that if you look at the places that were most touched by the violence over the last 52 years, the places most victimized by the war, that those places did vote yes. They did vote yes for this peace agreement, and that we see in the cities and other places that are relatively safe from the at least the last, 20 years of the conflict, voting no. And so I think that's a really important mark of that. Yeah, the victims want peace in Colombia, and they voted for it. I think that, the ex-president Uribe had a large political campaign encouraging people to vote no, and those reasons were, a lot of it, which aren't totally true, but saying that, the Las FARC and members of the guerrilla would receive amnesty for crimes. I think amnesty is one part of it, but people that did commit gross human rights violations were going to be sent to jail. And I think another thing is that part of the peace accords was a transitional justice that really focused on reconciliation, transitional justice for the victims of the war, rather than a punishment model where perpetrators would simply go to jail for anything they committed, but rather seeking ways to seek reconciliation within the civil population of Colombia. So a lot of people that supported Uribe rather have like a punitive type of justice done rather than a seek reconciliation between the victims and the perpetrators. And I think that was one of the reasons why you often hear that they're handing over all the human rights violations would be left in impunity, which isn't totally true if you read according to the accords. I think the other thing that happened there, and this is really interesting, is I think there was a part of the peace accords talked about the LGBTQ community as victims of the conflict, which is rightfully so. They've been targeted for social cleansing in the past, but that a lot of Christian churches, both Catholic and Protestant and evangelical, because it named LGBT community as particular victims of the conflict in a unique way, really felt like they couldn't support it because of that, which is really sad and totally disappointing, obviously.
Chris, I wanted to ask you about the intimidation factor. Are there armed right-wing paramilitary groups still in operation in Colombia that could have had an impact on this vote by intimidating and threatening voters who might have otherwise cast a ballot in favor of approving the peace agreement?
You know, I haven't heard or read any reports around specific paramilitary intimidation with this national referendum. What I do know is that since the peace accords were announced at the end of August in out of Havana, that around 15 human rights activists have been assassinated. We understand that on the ground is a direct relation to the announcement and paramilitary actors targeting human rights activists. The first person to be killed was someone on the ground that their farm was going to be used for the demobilization process, or one of the concentration zones where Las FARC was going to de-arm and give their weapons over and then enter civilian life. I think what we've seen is a restructuring and rising of paramilitaries and trying to get ready to take over the vacuum that will be left when, you know, the peace accords are finally, I still have hope that they're continuing to move forward, but I don't have any information right now about if that was influencing and so many people to vote no.
What is your expectation now that this referendum on the peace agreement has failed? Colombian President Juan Santos has said that he's going to be meeting again with FARC guerrillas to figure out what comes next. As I understand it, there was really no plan B in place to have a plan of action if the voters had rejected this referendum on the peace accord. And that, of course, has taken place now. What is your expectation for the next step?
A lot of people, including myself, we're not quite sure. You know, I think there's a lot of speculation around, you know, we do know that Las FARC EP have said publicly that they're not going to, you know, retake arms. You know, both parties are continuing to respect a bilateral ceasefire and that Las FARC is totally committed to these peace accords. I think Juan Manuel Santos has said that he is going to meet with the Center Democratic Party to kind of rework and think about how to move forward in the peace accords. I think that there's a lot of victims in Colombia. I would say that, you know, the victims of this conflict deserve peace and deserve reconciliation.
That was Chris Nestrick, a project support coordinator with Christian Peacemakers Colombia team. For more perspectives on the failed Colombian peace agreement referendum, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The Obama administration placed a temporary hold on further construction of the controversial Dakota Access Pipeline on September 9th. Thousands of indigenous opponents of the pipeline and their allies have established a protest encampment in North Dakota in order to stop the pipeline from crossing the Missouri River, which they maintain threatens sacred burial sites and the only source of drinking water for the Standing Rock Sioux tribe. But the company building the project, Energy Transfer Partners, has continued its preparation work on the project despite the Obama administration's request for a voluntary halt on both sides of the river. On September 27th, an indigenous attorney working on Native issues spoke at Yale University about the fight to stop the Dakota Access Pipeline and what it means for the Sioux and the broader fight for indigenous rights and sovereignty. Mary Catherine Nagel is a member of the Cherokee Nation and a partner with a Pipestem law firm, which is dedicated to protecting and enhancing the sovereign rights of tribal governments. She's also a nationally acclaimed playwright of indigenous-themed plays who has served as the executive director for Yale's Indigenous Performing Arts Program. Nagel began her talk at Yale with a quote from the chairman of the Standing Rock Sioux tribe.
History connects the dots of our identity, and our identity was all but obliterated. Our land was taken, our language was forbidden. Our stories, our history were almost forgotten. What land, language, and identity remains is derived from our cultural and historic sites. Sites of cultural and historic significance are important to us because they are a spiritual connection to our ancestors. Even if we do not have access to all such sites, their existence perpetuates the connection. When such a site is destroyed, the connection is lost. All of us are here in this room tonight because we agree that this is a powerful movement. It's an inspiring movement. It's a movement that is for Standing Rock, but we see a reflection of how it affects all of our lives. But at the same time, we are following their lead, right? This is their movement. This is about their sacred sites. This is about their water. This is about the lands that they have been protecting for thousands of years. And I think it's really important to honor and recognize that, and that when we lend our voices to this movement, that we don't try to appropriate it for our own uses, which can sometimes happen, especially in the United States. The company's goal was to build right up to the edge of the water, kind of on both sides, so that they could say, well, look, Judge, you know, we've put billions of dollars into this. Are you really going to stop it now just because some Indians are upset about the water? And they even said, and so, of course, in Standing Rock said, well, we've got, you know, it's not just the water. The water is very important, but also it's our sacred sites and our burial grounds. Our people have been buried here for thousands of years, and you can't just dig that up and put in a pipeline. Well, the company's response was, well, show us where these sites are. You say they're sacred sites. Where are these sites? So, actually, the Tribal Historic Preservation Officer went out. You know, a lot of this is private land now, even though it was historically treaty land, and it was Standing Rock's, the Great Sioux Nation's land. He had to go get permission to go on a private land, identify where the sites are. After they filed a court document saying, you want to know where the sites are, here they are. The next day, this Dakota Access Pipeline Company moved its construction crew several miles to those sites to start deconstructing and constructing on those sites. So that's when the folks at the camp went out peacefully, no weapons, no threats of violence, to the equipment to stop them from purposely destroying the tribe's sacred sites. And that's when the company's private security force unleashed violent dogs who bit several people, including a pregnant woman, to attack them. Another thing that I think is really important that I personally bring in terms of my work is the relationship between our environment, our land, and our women, and our tribal sovereignty. A lot of our grandmothers and our aunties would tell us, you know, there's a reason she's called Mother Earth, right? She's our mother. This is one of my favorite quotes from Vanessa Gray. The land is our mother. So when we lose value for the land, people lose value for the women. And that's actually what we've seen in North Dakota. So the Bakken oil region, this pipeline is going to increase the amount of oil extraction in a region that has already boomed tremendously in oil production to the point that North Dakota is now number one in the United States for exportation of oil out of the state. And it's now become one of the top states in the country for sexual assaults, rapes, murders, and sex trafficking, particularly of Native youth. Another really important thing to remember that a lot of what's happening at Standing Rock is really powerful, and I think it resonates with a lot of people. And a lot of people are saying this is about climate change, and this is an environmental movement. And yes, in part it is, right? It is about recognizing climate change is a problem and an important environmental movement in the United States. But these aren't new ideas, right? Like, in our tribal communities, we've had these understandings for thousands of years. This is a restoration of what was taken from us, right? So this living in balance with nature and the land and water and respecting that water is what sustains us and that our bodies are 80% water and that we die without water, you know, is not a new idea. It is a restoration of what was eradicated to make a lot of things around us in the United States possible. But now we have this amazing opportunity, thanks to a lot of the folks, the youth and the tribal leadership at Standing Rock, to wake up and come back to something we knew a long time ago.
That was playwright and Indigenous rights attorney Mary Catherine Nagel. This segment was recorded and produced by Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus. For more information on groups opposing the Dakota Access Pipeline and how to support activists who are planning on spending the winter at the pipeline construction site, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. According to public opinion polls conducted over the last year, Democratic Party nominee Hillary Clinton and the GOP's Donald Trump are the two most unpopular presidential candidates in recent American history. The campaign has been marked by Trump's insults, appeals to hatred, and a celebration of violence targeting immigrants and other minority groups. After years of charges of dishonesty and arrogance churned out by right-wing Republican-affiliated groups, as well as a series of major missteps, Hillary Clinton has become a polarizing figure, losing much of her appeal as America's first female major party presidential candidate, with the disappointment that comes from the perceived dilemma of having to choose between the lesser of two evils. Many voters have turned to support independent party candidates running this year, such as Libertarian Party nominee Gary Johnson and the Green Party candidate Jill Stein. Young, newly engaged voters, many of whom worked on behalf of Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders' campaign, are also considering casting a ballot for alternative candidates. Former New Mexico Governor Gary Johnson has had the most success this year in garnering support by appealing to both disgruntled Republican voters unhappy with Trump and disaffected Democrats disappointed with Hillary. But many voters don't know that Johnson and his Libertarian Party advocate a complete rollback of government, from the abandonment of student loans, environmental gun and health and safety regulations, to the privatization of public education and Social Security. Your reporter spoke with Adele Stan, senior Washington editor with Alternate.org, who examines Gary Johnson's views and the source of his funding, much of which comes from donors associated with the notorious right-wing activist Koch Brothers Network.
It's easy to be attracted to Johnson because of his favoring the legalization of marijuana and rhetoric, his anti-war rhetoric that he has issued. Although, if you go back in his history, he wasn't always quite so anti-war. But let's just get to what his ideology is. I mean, the guy opposes federal guarantees for student loans, for starters. I mean, I can't imagine how anybody, I mean, it's bad enough people are coming out of school with these huge debts, but without those federal guarantees of those loans, nobody's going to get a loan. So how are you going to go to college, period? He opposes virtually all forms of gun control. He opposes the minimum wage. He opposes collective bargaining for public employees. He proposes cuts to Social Security, and he wants to remove Medicare and Medicaid from federal control, meaning like they would, quote-unquote, block grant this money to the states. He supports private prisons. I mean, come on. So this is who this guy is. We still don't know that he doesn't have backing of the Koch brothers in this current campaign. We do know that one of Donald Trump's key advisors, Roger Stone, advised Johnson's 2012 campaign, and we also know that Roger Stone is a big proponent of using third-party candidates as spoilers in the service of a major party candidate. You know, I think there are a lot of questions to ask about who's bankrolling Johnson and why they're keeping him out there when obviously he's got no chance of winning and very little in the way of an agenda that you could imagine either of the two major party candidates adopting if they don't already embrace it.
Adele, outline for our listeners where Gary Johnson's money is coming from and the clues that those sources of funds offer to the ideological agenda of Gary Johnson and his candidacy.
We don't know where all of his money is coming from. All I can tell you is where he's getting some of his money. And his two largest donors are very interesting guys. One is Jeffrey Yass. Jeffrey Yass runs an options trading group. So the Susquehanna International Group is run by Jeffrey Yass, and Jeffrey Yass is a huge proponent of the privatization of public education, a.k.a. charter schools, school vouchers, you know, all of these different ways of siphoning tax dollars into the hands of private and religious entities. So Yaz has given $1 million to a Gary Johnson super PAC that is called Purple PAC. Purple PAC was founded by Ed Crane. Ed Crane was the founding president of the Cato Institute, a very famous libertarian think tank. Yaz sits on the board of the Cato Institute with David Koch, one of the billionaire Koch brothers. He also is part of this outfit called Students First, which is the project of somebody named Betsy DeVos. The DeVos family, they're huge players in both the religious right and in the neo-libertarian business right. I mean, they want to deregulate government controls on business. At the same time, they're using their religion to impose controls on people's bodies. And DeVos comes out of the family. That's the family that owned Amway, which many describe as a pyramid scheme. And the DeVos family is also part of the Koch network. And what is the Koch network? It's a constellation of, I'm sure your listeners are familiar with, a constellation of all kinds of entities, think tanks, organizing groups, that Charles and David Koch both contribute to, but also bring all of their rich friends, who are also private capitalists, together to donate to, and the money gets passed around in ways that's untraceable. Now, the other guy who's giving big bucks to a Gary Johnson super PAC is a guy named Chris Roofer, who runs the Morningstar Packing Company in California, which is a tomato grower and processor. And Roofer is, you know, flat-out libertarian. He doesn't believe that any land he owns should be, you know, subject to any kind of environmental regulation. He is currently been slapped with a $1.5 million fine by the Central Valley Water Control Board in California for pollution. And he has contributed to Gary Johnson super PAC that is promoting this idea that people who would ordinarily be inclined to vote Democrat can swap their vote for Johnson with somebody who would ordinarily be inclined to vote Republican, and it all even out in the wash, and it won't hurt either one of the major party candidates.
That was Adele Stan, senior Washington editor with Alternet.org and a columnist with the American Prospect. Find a link to Stan's recent article titled Meet Gary Johnson's Koch Network Money Men and related articles by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Denise Manzari, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay. The reparations case. Ever since the end of slavery, Africans in America have been hoping for and seeking reparations for wrongs done against them for centuries. Initially, after the U.S. Civil War ended, Africans were offered 40 acres of land and a mule to work the land that they had worked without pay for centuries. This promise was never fulfilled. The great abolitionist and religious leader Sojourner Truth, who was once a captive, called for reparation, saying, "America owes to my people some of the dividends. I shall make them understand that there is a debt to the Negro people which they can never repay. At least then, they must make amends." From the day it was first uttered to this day, literally in the shadow of bondage, the voices of black people called for reparations. It may surprise some, but the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. added his voice to that call. In his 1963-64 book, Why We Can't Wait, King wrote, "No amount of gold could provide an adequate compensation for the exploitation and humiliation of the Negro in America down through the centuries. Not all the wealth of this affluent society could meet the bill. Yet, a price can be placed on unpaid wages." King may not have said the word reparations, but he certainly stated the idea. Recently, the Movement for Black Lives, known also as the Black Lives Matter Movement, issued a platform of issues important to black well-being. Among the issues raised, reparations for descendants of African captives. Even more recently, a United Nations working group of experts on people of African descent, working for some 6 years, has concluded that U.S. slavery was a crime against humanity, and the U.S. government should pay reparations to the descendants of those humans who were wronged. The U.N. experts met with members of half a dozen U.S. government agencies, including the Departments of Health and Human Services, Labor, and Justice. They visited several major American cities, north, south, east, and west. Reparations may have come of age after two centuries of being ignored and shunned. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. The politics of challenge, equal sign, the politics of change. The most consequential political presidential season of modern American history is afoot, and within days, the direction of the empire will be set into electoral stone. The choices presented to the voting populace is one that could hardly be less appetizing. The spoiled billionaire brat, Donald J. Trump, versus Her Highness Hillary Rodham, although she doesn't use her maiden name these days, Clinton. And the race is, in a numerical sense, inches apart. That this is so, that an outrageous political novice could be within striking distance of Clinton, a political figure in her own right, as former First Lady, wife, partner of past President William Jefferson Clinton, Secretary of State under President Barack Obama, and former U.S. Senator from New York, is a rather telling tale of her political woes and weaknesses. Imagine where Bernie Sanders would be head-to-head against Trump. It is also a sobering reflection of how rejectionist is the U.S. electorate and how hungry they are for change. Any change. Bernie, anyone? And yet, the die is cast. The clock ticks away. And the fate of the empire is likely to be determined by the swing votes, not of any state particularly, but by the voting choices determined by the black vote, that nebulous, numerous variable that can set the scene of this political tragicomedy. With that kind of power, that strategic leverage, what are blacks demanding? What promises have they exacted from either major political choice? The answer is as sad as it is almost inevitable. Nothing. So beaten, so battered, so desperate are black lives in this aging empire, so hungry are they for simple recognition that millions will vote, and mostly for Hillary, in hope, with promises of nothing. Nothing. How can we be surprised when that is precisely what we will get? Power, said the great Frederick Douglass, concedes nothing without demand. What have black politicians, black preachers, black feminists demanded? A repeal of AEDPA, A-E-D-P-A, the law that suspended and truncated habeas corpus? A 50% reduction of mass incarceration? An end to the police industrial complex? What? The only voices that emerge from the black and youth community that dare criticize Her Highness and the political poison personified by her husband, President Clinton, has been Black Lives Matter. But among the insiders, the politicians, nothing. So black Americans, who have the most to lose among all Americans, hang on to hope and little else. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
I'm officially a terrorist now, according to the state of Ohio, the rogue state holding me hostage. I received the conduct report that stems from the Nazis seizing the handwritten script of one of my radio segments, and it actually contains the word terrorist. Let me read to you what the Nazis wrote. Check this out. On September 8th at approximately 12:30 p.m., Officer Spencer conducted a search of inmate Swain, 243205. During the search, some documents were retrieved. One of them was a letter which included language that indicates possible terrorist-type activities. One of the paragraphs talks about an organized effort of inmates to have a work stoppage, but the writer, inmate Swain, says that he is not endorsing it. Other paragraphs talk about specific ways to disrupt correctional operations, but the writer, inmate Swain, writes that he is saying to do it. The material is telling the readers how to conduct these activities in detail. However, he makes sure to add that he is not saying to actually do it, as to cover his liability and to get the message across at the same time. There was also a self-authored booklet confiscated, which includes anti-government material. Yep, I'm now officially a terrorist, folks. The Nazis said so. But don't forget, my language that indicates possible terrorist-type activities, whatever in the hell that means, was recorded for the final straw. And the final straw is broadcast on airwaves regulated by the Federal Communications Commission. The show is broadcast from a real radio station with electricity and equipment and a powerful antenna. A radio station with corporate sponsors who sell breakfast pastries and beer and tampons. Then, as I understand it, the show gets rebroadcast from other real radio stations all over the world, all with their own corporate sponsors. So think about this. If my radio segment really promoted terrorism, that involves a complicated international terrorist conspiracy. First, the final straw would have to be down with terrorism since it broadcasts my incoherent nonsense. Second, the radio station would have to be down with terrorism too. And third, as an extension of the radio station being down with terrorism, that means the continuing corporate sponsors selling pastries and beer and tampons are knowingly supporting terrorism. But fourth, it also means that the FCC, an agency of the federal government, is rubber-stamping my terrorism with their inaction. That's quite a terrorist conspiracy that Warren Corruptional's oblivious cage worshippers have managed to uncover. The entire sprawling capitalist corporate megastructure is continuing to fund my terrorist messaging, and the FCC is facilitating it. Wow. We're bigger than ISIS. But it's even deeper than that. Since the conduct report was written, containing the word terrorist, I've spent the better part of a week in population at a level 3 prison. I strolled all over the compound, conversing with prisoners on a regular basis, meeting with folks at the library, possibly spreading my terrorist plots.
And it hasn't so much as occurred to anyone that someone like me, a terrorist, should perhaps be segregated or even shipped off to the Super Duper Max. You know, the prison where my involvement in the radio show began. This is inexplicable to me. My best guess is that Warden Shea Harris must be part of my terrorist network. Somebody needs to contact the FBI right away. This hapless clown is facilitating my terrorism, right along with the FCC, corporate America, and the famous dead guy who invented the radio. Warren Corruptional Security Threat Group investigators are going to have to dig him up and interrogate him. Not Shea Harris, the guy who invented the radio. But you know who else is involved in this terrorist conspiracy? Lieutenant Kevin Chamberlain, who wrote the conduct report. Yesterday I handed him material from my cell that is both anti-government and supports what he's called terrorism. I told him I'd get even more stuff together so he could write 25 more conduct reports. After all, we can't have a terrorist like me running around at a level 3 prison, right? He declined. He refused to write 25 more conduct reports. I guess the ISIS High Command must have turned him or something. The warden, the FCC, corporate America, Alexander Graham Bell, and now even Lieutenant Kevin Chamberlain are part of my terrorist conspiracy. And if Lieutenant Nelson, the chair of the Rules Infraction Board, doesn't send me straight to the Super Duper Max, we can only assume he's secretly involved in this terrorist conspiracy, too. Wow. Whoever investigates all of this sure is going to really need a big detective bag. This is anarchist prisoner Sean Swain from Warren Correctional in Lebanon, Ohio. If you're listening, you're probably a terrorist, too.
You can write to Sean Swain at Sean Swain, 243-205, Warren, C.I., P.O. Box 120, 5787 State Route 63, Lebanon, Ohio, 45036. For updates on his situation, his bid for U.S. President in 2016, and more writings by Sean can be found at seanswain.org.
What stories have Canadian media consistently failed to cover? What stories featuring Indigenous peoples have been misrepresented in subtle and not so subtle ways? What forces in Canadian society are at work to influence the news stories Canadians consume and how? What role do Canada's academic institutions play in distorting the nature of Canadian foreign policy? Is there a fundamental difference between Canada's propaganda model and that of other countries? This week, on the Global Research News Hour, we take a critical look at the Fourth Estate as it exists in Canada and the inaccurate image of the country it has fostered in the minds of its citizens. We'll speak with John Chertow, editor and founder of Intercontinental Cry, about the undermining of Indigenous people's stories in Canada. We'll also speak with Eve Engler, Montreal-based foreign policy critic and author of a new book on how elite manipulation of Canadian media has shaped myths about Canada's benevolent presence on the world stage. On this week's program, Inventing Reality in the Great White North, conversations with John Chertow and Eve Engler on media in Canada. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of October 7th, 2016. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available for the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Promoted by the U.S., torture, arbitrary arrest, and incarceration have become the norm, creating lawless and chaotic societies, which had once been productive and stable. The shredding of social structures has provoked massive population flight, with millions of desperate refugees fleeing invasions, wars, and total society breakdown. The result of these deliberate imperial policy decisions has been emptied cities and neighborhoods, broken families, destroyed lives, and futures for many millions of young Arabs and Muslims. As the human toll mounts and Western Europe is flooded with the results of U.S. aggressive wars, the imperialists have sharpened their shrill rhetoric, labeling all of their adversaries and critics as accomplices in war crimes and barbarians. The greater and more sustained the policy of wanton imperial pillage, the more intense the frustration of its leaders over its ultimate failures, and the greater the recourse of its diplomats to vituperative language. That comes from the article, Barbarism in Words and Deeds, Barbarism of U.S. Imperial Wars is Unmatched, by Professor James Petrus, posted October 3rd. Posing as an impartial rescue force, the White Helmets, quote-unquote, are transparently auxiliaries serving exclusively side-by-side armed militants, including U.S. State Department, UN, and EU-designated foreign terrorist organizations. Their primary function is not rescuing anyone, but to manage a public relations campaign aimed at swaying public and political opinion, leveraging humanitarian sympathy worldwide. Their primary means of doing this is publishing photos and videos of their members wearing elaborate matching uniforms and driving brand new ambulances, pulling dust and blood-covered victims from rubble allegedly brought down upon them by Syrian and Russian airstrikes. The veracity of their photos, videos, and many claims have never been independently verified, and in many cases, evidence suggests that much of what they present to the public across their extensive, well-funded social media presence has been fabricated. The recent coordinated Save Aleppo protests held across Europe and North America perhaps revealed just how transparently fabricated and fictional the White Helmets' work really is. That comes from the article, White Helmet, Save Aleppo Protest Proves How Easy It Is to Dress Up Actors as War Victims, by Tony Cardellucci, posted October 3rd, originally appearing at Land Destroyer Report. In recent months, elite black athletes have begun protesting white racism by challenging the requirement for choreographed displays of flag worship, opening public controversy into the larger issues of police brutality and sustained marginalization. Identity politics, which led to the election of Obama, may be giving way to issues of class struggle, racial justice, anti-militarism, and the impact of continued imperial wars. Hysterical rants may still secure international attention, but repeated performances begin to lose their impact and subject the ranter to ridicule. The cult of victimology has become less a rationale for the multi-billion-dollar U.S. tribute to Israel than the overwhelming political and economic influence and thuggery of billionaire Zionist fundraisers who demand U.S. politicians' support for the State of Israel. Brandishing identity politics may have worked the first few times, but inevitably, black, Latino, immigrant, and all exploited workers, all underpaid and overworked women and mothers reject the empty symbolic gestures and demand substantive socioeconomic changes, and here they find common links with the majority of exploited white workers. That comes from the article, Propaganda Techniques of Empire, by Professor James Petrus, posted October 3rd. According to Jane's Defense Weekly, quoting documents released by the U.S. government's Federal Business Opportunities, or the FBO, the U.S., as part of its counterterrorism campaign, has provided Syrian rebels, a.k.a. moderate al-Qaeda, with large amounts of weapons and ammunition. The U.S. and its allies, including Turkey and Saudi Arabia, have relied on the illicit trade in light weaponry produced in Eastern Europe, the Balkans, China, etc., for delivery to rebel groups inside Syria, including ISIS, Daesh, and al-Nusra. These shipments of weapons are not conducted through internationally approved weapons transfers. While they are the result of a Pentagon or U.S. government procurement, they are not recorded as official military aid. They use private traders and shipping companies within the realm of a thriving illicit trade in light weapons. That comes from the article, U.S. Military Aid to Al-Qaeda, ISIS, Daesh. Pentagon uses illicit arms trafficking to channel enormous shipments of light weapons into Syria, by Professor Michelle Chalsadovsky, posted October 2nd. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. You're tuned to the Global Research News Hour podcast at globalresearch.ca and aired on CKUW and on partner community radio stations across Canada and the United States. Today's episode is dedicated to the ways and means by which Canadians are misled by their media about government and industry operations at home and abroad. This week, our host radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada, is celebrating a special annual event called Pass the Mic Week, where we allow community members an opportunity to take a stab at hosting a radio program. I've decided to extend that opportunity to my very good friend, Kim Lee Wong, who's sitting here in the studio with me. She is a member of Saging First Nation. She's a mother of three, holds a degree of master's in the environment. She's performed social justice work in Southeast Asia and at the United Nations. And she's also produced investigative stories for the Aboriginal People's Television Network. So, Kim Lee, welcome to Global Research News Hour.
Hey, thanks for having me, Michael.
Okay, so joining us by phone is John Shurto of Intercontinental Cry. So I figure, Kim Lee, you can introduce our guest and go right into a discussion.
Oh, great. Okay, good afternoon. Hello. Today we're with John Anawanika Shurto. He's Mohawk and an Indigenous activist. He's also editor and founder of IntercontinentalCry.org, an online platform dedicated to covering Indigenous stories worldwide that get passed over by other media. Thank you for joining us, John.
Niawa, thank you for having me.
Just to get started, can you give us some background into who and what is Intercontinental Cry?
Well, it's an investigative news platform that I started over a decade ago in response to the media's systemic underrepresentation and marginalization of Indigenous voices, in Canada and internationally. Over the years, we've gathered about 50 Indigenous and non-Indigenous journalists to help all Indigenous peoples around the world get their voices out into the world. To date now, we've covered the frontline struggles of about 650 Indigenous nations globally, which is arguably more than all other Canadian media combined during the life of IC. We also produce our own documentaries and print our own magazines. But first and foremost, we focus on producing investigative journalism.
Wow, yeah. So you said you've been around for a decade?
Yeah, since 2004.
Wow, that's a long time.
It is. I spent about a year trying to discover for myself the struggles that Indigenous peoples were facing around the world. I was already very aware of how things were historically and currently at the time in Canada. But I wanted to understand the struggle of the Mapuche, the Maori, and just all other Indigenous peoples, and there were no reliable sources of news and analysis online at the time that really focused on the entire spectrum of Indigenous peoples. There's over 5,000 Indigenous nations in the world, and you know, there just was no good place to go. And, you know, it really concerned me, considering, you know, like, for example, there's over 100 struggles against hydro dams in the world. And, you know, most people would never know that, never mind be able to find a place where they can discover more than one. So, you know, I started IC just to, you know, bring everything together.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it's just been growing steadily since then.
Yes, I remember hearing about you, like, long ago, and I thought it was this huge organization that was operating and doing things because of the way you've covered, like, so widely, and comprehensively these stories. It's great.
Yeah.
And so why do you think these stories are important for mainstream?
Well, you know, like, well, for one, Indigenous peoples tend to be leaders in a variety of ways. Like Indigenous peoples are leading the charge against climate change. They are ushering in a new era of conservation. They're holding governments accountable. They're preventing efforts to roll back environmental rights and, you know, and civil rights. They're also, you know, preventing corporations from, you know, utterly obliterating what precious, you know, pristine ecosystems we have left. Like there's a good stat by the World Wildlife Fund, which, you know, points out that Indigenous peoples are currently the stewards of 95% of the world's most threatened biodiversity. And, you know, they're actively defending, you know, these lands and ecosystems around the world. You know, they're literally living on the front lines. And it's, you know, and they're defending, you know, all of us, not just, you know, their own, not just, you know, our own lands and rights and histories, but, you know, they're, you know, protecting everything. And
the water and the air and the land for everyone.
Absolutely. And food systems. And, you know, yeah. And it's important for...
having local control, yeah.
Exactly. And, you know, it's very important for the international community to know this, and also to, you know, understand who Indigenous peoples are, because, you know, most people don't.
Mm-hmm.
And also to be able to, you know, support and get involved in these efforts, because, like this is like the earth at stake, right? And we all have a stake in it. Even if Indigenous peoples are, you know, for the most part, primary stakeholders, because they literally live on the front line, whereas, you know, most people in urban centers don't, it's still like we all have to get involved. And so it's in order for most people to get involved, we first have to know what's happening.
It's almost like Indigenous stories seem to be trending now. And like you mentioned, like, mainstream wasn't covering a lot of stories and stuff. But like, if you look at CBC, even CTV and some of the newspapers, they're covering more Indigenous stories than a few years ago. What do you think about this?
It's true, yeah. And even ironically enough, Indigenous-led media is also doing a better job. I know, like, when APTN first started out, they were very reluctant to cover, you know, tense situations, like with mining companies and whatnot. And I think they were very concerned about the CRTC thinking that they were too radical or something, right? And so they, you know, they tread lightly. But, you know, over time and as they got more secure, financially and socially, they, you know, they opened up the valves. But there are still a lot of limitations in the more mainstream outlets when it comes to the specific stories that are going to be told. And there's also still, you know, a lot of racism and bias and refusal to really dig deep into the stories. The CBC is doing an admirable job, I think. But there's still a lot of growth that needs to take place in Canada's media complex.
So what are some of the challenges you face in covering Indigenous stories?
Well, the biggest one is total and complete lack of funding. I've been trying to find funding now for 2 years, specifically approaching foundations in Canada and the United States, so that we can, you know, really expand our work and start providing salaries to our editors, and also to compensate our journalists and support them in the field. And, you know, so far we haven't found a single foundation.
Oh, really? Yeah, that will cover alternative media? Or?
Yeah, 2 years, okay. And, you know, we haven't, not a single one has, in fact, none of the foundations we've approached have even been willing to hear out our full proposals. And, like we've designed a series of programs to go far beyond our primary mandate. Like, we've developed an online Indigenous journalism training course and a culture-sharing program for Indigenous youth on reserve that would be situated on IC. And, you know, nobody wants to dig into any of this stuff. Maybe it's because I lack grant writing skills. I don't know, but, yeah.
Funding.
Funding has been the biggest problem. And I guess the other major challenge we've had is finding journalists who are willing to donate their time because we can't afford to pay them. And, you know, because of that, you know, the amount of coverage that we've been able to provide, even though we provide more than most others, is still extremely limited. I would estimate that there are at least 90 major stories a month that, as far as I'm concerned, should be getting just as much coverage as the struggle against the Dakota Access Pipeline right now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, situations where communities are being literally submerged underwater, such as the case with the Nove Bugle in Panama. Where, you know, militaries are shooting at, you know, Indigenous children from helicopters in Tanzania, and, you know, there's just so many things, and
mm-hmm.
you know, and there's many good stories too, but
so much of this isn't getting covered though. Yeah.
It's really not, and
what are some of the stories that have stuck out for you, or you've been doing this a lot of years? Are there stories? Or stories that haven't been covered at all that you've covered?
There's so many. you know, one of my favorite stories actually was when the Anishinaabeg Nation decided to ban the word Aboriginal from their vocabulary. I love that story. You know, stories like that where, you know, Indigenous communities are, you know, just, you know, rejecting whatever doesn't serve them, and you know, reinvigorating their own cultures, languages, customs. Another example is the Wampus Nation in Peru. Just earlier this year, the Wampus, who became very popular internationally in 2009, when the government opened fire on them. It was a huge situation. But now they've established one of the first territorial governments that have existed in Latin America. So, like, things yeah. like this, I think, are truly inspiring. And, you know, where Indigenous peoples are, you know, taking matters into their own hands and, you know, adopting the standards and ethics that sustained them centuries before colonialism was even an idea. And, you know, bringing this back and, you know, pushing it in such a way that it encourages, you know, governments and corporations and non-governmental organizations to, you know, act more responsibly, you know, to encouraging them to adopt a new ethic that, you know, respects people and land,
mm-hmm.
and not just, you know, dollar signs. So, like, things like this, I think, are absolutely wonderful.
Do you feel that there's still stories that aren't being told? Or that the mainstream media shies away from for different reasons?
Absolutely. I mean, I don't think anybody's ever told, anybody in Canada has ever really told the story of the history of displacement in and around Uranium City in northern Saskatchewan. You know, there were Indigenous communities that were displaced there back in the 50s, and you know, so that's one example.
Mm-hmm.
There's a history of forced sterilization of Indigenous women in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen much coverage on that. We put out a story last year about that. You know, there's ongoing oil spills in northern BC. You know, and then of course we have situations also in right here in Manitoba. That have historically received very little coverage, like the situation with Shoal Lake, where the First Nation where Winnipeg gets its water from. You know, that was ignored for almost 100 years, but now that's getting, you know, a lot better
mm-hmm.
coverage. And, of course, we have a situation with Lake St. Martin. The government displaced Lake St. Martin from their land in 2011, and, you know, there was no no huge outcry, right?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting you mention that because it seems like the stories I remember about Lake St. Martin that have been in the news talk more about the fact that people are living in, you know, or some of the kind of social dysfunction that is happening with people who are still stuck in living in an urban center that's not their home and in hotels.
Yeah.
And I see those kind of stories have been kind of covered.
Yeah. But like the core thing, and it really has been like the initial like the cause, was really ignored, and it's unfortunate, and it's especially disheartening for me as somebody who has been focused on the quote unquote alternative side of things, right? I mean, why aren't alternative publications covering these things too? It's not just mainstream; it's the more independent or nonprofit. Who are also failing Indigenous peoples.
I wonder, like you mentioned the funding issue, and like do you get any kind of sponsorship or advertisement funding?
Not at this point. We're trying to find some organizations, oddly enough, in Europe, because journalism is supported very heavily in Europe over the past couple of years, far more than it is in Canada and the U.S. So we're trying to find some organizations there to partner with and help us. And to sponsor us.
Some of the mainstream media, when they're covering different stories, like you mentioned too, sometimes they don't really get to the core of the issues. They're covering the surface of the issue. So in presenting stories this way to the mainstream public, do you think it's helping or hurting? People's struggles.
It really comes down to the kind of spin that's going to be in the story. A lot of the more mainstream stories that are published really tend to lean in favor of corporate interests, and so they frame it in such a way that doesn't necessarily respect the needs, rights, and economies of the First Nations who are involved. But, like the old saying goes that any good exposure is, or any bad exposure is still good exposure, or whatever that cliche is. So it still helps in that way. I mean, mainstream media has such a massive outreach that it allows us to at least talk about it. It brings the issues to the forefront. The question there, though, is whether or not the narratives that do come forward can be managed in a socially responsible way. And, because there's a lot of racism in Canada, and because the media doesn't really have accept a social responsibility when it comes to how it portrays Indigenous peoples, it can make problems worse. And I think we saw that well during the height of Idle No More, when, Canada the media complex went on the attack against Chief Theresa Spence. And, it fomented racism in Canada and, took everything out of control. And that, in turn, basically destroyed Idle No More. In the very least, it killed the momentum.
Mm-hmm.
It would be nice if media organizations actually took a little bit more responsibility in that regard instead of just, following trends or listening to whatever the government wants, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Alternative media should do the same. I mean, we have a responsibility to tell stories that need to be told, to do it fairly and responsibly. And, that's the kind of standard that we put at IC. It's important. These stories have real-life impacts that destroy families, communities, and nations if they're done irresponsibly. It's not like, journalists don't just get to wash their hands and walk away, right? We all need to be, responsible. And, hopefully.
And the more subtle messages we're sending, when we're doing stories.
Absolutely.
And that's it. Again, I just want to say, Intercontinental Cry, if people don't know about it, check it out, intercontinentalcry.org. You do amazing stories from all around the world. It's great to see, that this is happening, that these stories are being told. I think it's important for, like you said, it's inspirational. It's important for people to see that when they're struggling, that other communities have similar struggles and are successful. There's challenges we share, lessons to be learned. There's so much commonality. Like, I travel to Southeast Asia and down to Central. Like, it's just amazing how similar cultures can be.
It is, and it's
the value systems and stuff. And so there's, yeah, a lot of ways to learn and from each other and just share, which is great what you do. And just getting back to some of the funding issues, I hear you have a fundraiser coming up.
Yeah, on October 10th, actually, we're going to be starting a campaign on Patreon.com. And we're focusing on bringing an end to this marginalization and misrepresentation of Indigenous peoples. So we're raising funds to give IC everything it needs to function successfully and to ensure that all Indigenous peoples are getting the media coverage that they need. So yeah, if anybody wants to learn about that, they can head over to our website stay tuned for updates on that. So,
if people want to donate to Intercontinental Cry, is it online or is it there's a place to mail things? Is there
things? It's strictly online. Okay. It's going to be patreon.com/indigenousjournalism.
Okay. And they can find it on your website too.
Yep.
Yes. So, yes, I suggest everyone run out and look at that, read some of these stories and
sure.
Be informed and inspired.
Absolutely.
Thank you, John.
You're
doing great work.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, John, and thank you, Kim Lee, for that wonderful interview.
Well, thanks for the opportunity.
Yeah, absolutely.
That was John Shurto, editor and founder of Intercontinental Cry. He was speaking with special guest interviewer Kim Lee Wong. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. Many of our listeners are familiar with the idea of media censoring or distorting news to advance elite interests. We're not necessarily that familiar, however, with exactly how this process takes place in Canada. What are the structural instruments and methods that allow our news to be effectively manufactured? It turns out there is a new book on this that's just come out, A Propaganda System, How Canada's Government, Corporations, Media, and Academia Sell War and Exploitation. And Eve Engler, the author, is about to embark on a tour, launching his book, Across Canada Tour, and it's my pleasure to have him back. How are you, Eve Engler?
I'm good. How are you, Mike?
Not too bad. So do you find that coverage of foreign affairs, the success by which this propaganda apparatus happens on the foreign affairs front is somehow dramatically different from what coverage of domestic issues?
Yeah, I mean, the dominant media reflects the power imbalances in society in general, right? So, it's obviously slanted towards the corporate perspective. It's, slanted against Indigenous peoples. It's slanted against minimum wage workers. It's slanted against those who are less powerful in general. But on foreign policy, it's particularly stark seeing the bias, lack of there being a countervailing force in this country that is engaged on the issues of foreign policy in a serious way. All that leads to a media environment where it's the range of debate is just incredibly narrow, and there's all kinds of very sort of good reasons for it. So, for instance, the Canadian military is the largest PR department in this country. I would suggest that the Canadian military's spending on public relations would be into the hundreds and hundreds of times what all peace organizations in the country combined spend on articulating their message. There would be there's into the hundreds and hundreds of employees that work full time for the Canadian military trying to get out the Canadian military's message, trying to portray what Canada does abroad, what Canadian military does abroad in a positive light. The number of people working at that versus the number of people who are employed by peace organizations in Canada would be into the, you know, hundreds of times more on the military front. So there's, you know, very good structural reasons for why the bias is so stark on foreign policy, but you know, from the standpoint of morality and of accuracy, it's obviously a major problem that needs to be challenged and overcome.
You mentioned the military as PR machine. You're seeing it in all kinds of levels, and you know, air shows and whatnot. But it's not just about putting out press releases. They're trying to craft an affinity for military culture.
Yeah, I mean, basically, if you can think of a way of trying to sell militarism, they're probably doing it. That would be, you know, the extent of it. So, I mean, from getting ads in video games, you know, recruitment ads in video games targeting it at young men, to obviously the example of the military's contract with the Winnipeg Jets to craft the logo, you know, air shows, to you know, ads on bus shelters, to obviously to, you know, the prominent ads on Hockey Night in Canada, that, you know, the ads that cost hundreds and thousands of dollars for a 30-second spot. There's militaries using public money to advance militarism, to advance their perspective, but also it's important to look at how they you know, manipulate journalists and the news media, and you know, when it comes to one of the examples I go into is you know, how they contrasting how they treat journalists in Afghanistan to air wars. So for instance, when Canada's bombing in Libya, the military has been generally on air wars, bombing campaigns. They're very secretive about what information they'll let out, because they understand that basically the media is completely reliant upon them for any information, because, you know, airplanes coming in and dropping bombs overhead, it's very difficult for you know, someone on the ground somewhere to figure out what, you know, what country those planes are from, what the planes are doing exactly. It's happening, obviously, you know, so far above what people can see. Now, conversely, when it comes to Afghanistan, how the Canadian military treated the media was very much to bring journalists close and to try to have journalists see the conflict in Afghanistan, the Canadian war, Canadian occupation in Afghanistan, from, you know, 2001 to 2011, to see that from the perspective of soldiers on the ground, and basically almost to you know, obviously to embed journalists with the military, and to try to create a situation where the journalists could only see the perspective of the Canadian forces. So you know, they're working at every different level, also from the level of the, you know, their own history departments, right? The Canadian military has this major history department where they're writing official histories of Canada's military history, and they've been doing this for basically a century, and that's you know, has played an important part in the academic discussion about Canada's role in the world, and the Canadian military's role in the world. So basically, the military is engaged at shaping the discussion of Canadian militarism at almost every different possible level.
So you talk, are you referring to these military institutes, like the Royal Canadian Military Institute, and the I guess the Conference of Defense Associations, and like they're having that role in effectively determining official history that the journalists and researchers are, you know, would turn to in order to try to provide some context for current operations?
Yeah, I mean, in that case, I would say, I mean, what I was referring to previously was specifically the history department of the DND, of the Canadian Forces. But also, you're right to point out an important component of their influence within the media, their influence within academia, their influence just in general in sort of the political culture is through arm's length organizations, different groups that there's either they fund, in the case of the Conference and Events Association, you know, very close ties at the level of different institute think tanks that they have ties to, basically the people think when people, you know, see the name of you know some spokesperson from say Conference of Defense Associations, from Royal Canadian Military Institute, even from academic departments, oftentimes those groups are being funded by the Canadian military. The DND's Security Defense Forum funds more than a dozen security or defense programs at universities across the country, and spends a few million dollars a year in channeling money to academics, to academics who generally articulate a sympathetic perspective of the Canadian military and of, you know, Canadian geopolitical perspective.
Well, that sounds kind of similar. I mean, what we've heard also, like when we talk about, you know, medical research and, you know, a lot of dollars flowing from pharmaceutical corporations, and that can determine which clinical trials get funded and which ones don't. So if you want to get your research funded, that kind of restricts your options in that realm. And are we talking about a similar phenomenon here if you don't take a kind of a military boosteristic or a certain vision of Canada as this great fighter for freedom, that your research is not going to get a lot of support?
I mean, that's exactly it. It's not taking place at some sort of like big conspiratorial level. It's taking place at the very, you know, a small concrete level of, if you are you know, just finished your master's degree and you're looking to continue on in the sort of academic world, if you do research that tends to align with the perspective of the Canadian military, your likelihood of getting access to research funds, having some sort of obvious career path, increases. If you do, you know, peace research, or even, you know, furthermore, if you would, you know, look to anti-imperialist research, your avenues for funding are very limited. And there's, you know, one example I discuss in the book of at McMaster University in their peace studies program. It took them, I think, over 17 years. They set up a program. It took them over 17 years to find any funding to actually hire somebody. It was all cross postings from other programs to actually be able to hire somebody directly, and that's because there just aren't the same sources of funding. There's not an arm of the Canadian government, or there's not an arm of, you know, let's say labor unions or whatever that are funding you know, peace research, and even less that are funding you know, even sort of, you know, more critical kind of research outlook. And the cumulative effect of these types of dynamics is that you have a situation where you know, people who have a more critical outlook just tend to stop pursuing an academic avenue, will in some cases maybe sort of try to fit their outlook into places where they can have access to funds. But at a broad societal level, you know, it leads to a situation where we don't have a proper understanding about Canada's role in the world, and that enables the decision makers to get away with a lot of things that I think most Canadians would be very uncomfortable about if they understood what was actually taking place.
You mentioned in the book, in particular, one Peter Monk and this Monk Center. Do you want to talk a little bit about that, the role that entity. I mean, Peter Monk of Barrick Gold, which is a major mining company abroad, how that particular think tank or that academic institution has contributed to this contortion of Canadians' views on what it does on the international stage.
Yeah, well, the Monk School of Global Affairs at the University of Toronto is probably the most influential university international studies school. And its funder, Peter Monk, whose beginning relationship goes back to the mid-1990s, Peter Monk would be, if you were going to, you know, look through 35 million Canadians, Peter Monk would be among the least credible sources of funding for a School of International Affairs. He is somebody who has major personal self-interest via Barrick Gold, the company he founded, the biggest gold company in the world that operates in six continents, incredibly controversial corporation. So that's a company that has, you know, depends on diplomatic support by Canadian officials, that's received all kinds of Canadian aid money, export financing from the Canadian government, is a company that's incredibly aggressively opposed to all attempts to tie government support to companies that have, you know, companies that have been engaged in abuses abroad, lose government support, as there's been, you know, campaigns to adopt legislation. So Peter Monk is also incredibly an extreme right-wing ideologue who's made all kinds of comments from about Chile to Palestinians to indigenous people that are incredibly reactionary kind of outlook. And he's the funder of the most influential global studies program at Canadian University. Going back to the mid-1990s, he made his donation to the University of Toronto contingent upon them taking advice from Barrick Gold's International Advisory Board, which at that point included George Bush, the first Bush presidency president, and also Prime Minister Brian Mulroney. So he's organized his donations to the Monk School also to give him a whole bunch of leverage. And over the years, he's made a number of major donations. The Monk School of Global Affairs is but one example. If you take a look at the Norman Patterson School of International Affairs at Carleton University, which is quite a prestigious school, it also has the oldest global affairs school in Canada. Its history is completely tied into officials at external affairs and big funding by a liberal senator who was very close to Lester Pearson and very close to the external affairs department in the mid-1960s. If you take a look at the Basili schools in Waterloo, this is also funded by the former head of BlackBerry or Research in Motion, RIM, Jim Basili. So if you take a look at academic departments across the country, you find that and I missed a whole number of examples in the book of different departments that are engaged in sort of international affairs type work, and they're often funded by different rich Canadians who have a certain outlook on world affairs.
You also mention in the book, and this is something I find particularly interesting, is that the financial support of foundations, like the Ford Foundation and the Donner Canadian Foundation and the Open Society Institute, and how that, you know, you'll have all that funding coming in, for certain entities with a specific viewpoint, and those that might offer a more contrarian or dissident perspective end up being marginalized for lack of being able to keep up in terms of funding. That's another ingredient of this propaganda system, is it not?
It is. I don't go into it in significant detail in the book, and I'm actually going into it in more detail in a follow-up of volume two that looks at a bit more of the sort of left forces engagement in Canadian foreign policy. But you will find that on foreign policy, there's almost no source of institutional funding for, you know, critical for a critical institute or for a left-wing foreign policy think tank. In the case of the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives, in the case of the Broadbent Institute, which are the preeminent left-wing think tanks, they deal almost entirely with domestic issues. And their source of funding, a major source of their funding, are labor unions. But in the case of foreign policy, there's literally no think tank or institute that I would consider that a sort of genuine critical perspective. And that the impact of that is it's one small piece in a much bigger propaganda system where there isn't the source of support for critical foreign policy think tank.
Now, I think at probably the most basic level, I think there's an understanding out there that for private broadcasters or private newspapers, if you have a major advertiser, it's hard for that paper to criticize that advertiser. But when it comes to, say, the CBC or Canadian Press, have those institutions historically found themselves to be aligned with the major power interests of the country, particularly with regard to war?
Yeah, well, I mean, the CBC, in its beginnings, was just before World War II. And during World War II, it was completely explicitly aligned with the government. And to the point where, when there was the referendum around conscription, where Mackenzie King had reversed his position he initially said there would not be any conscription, and then he reversed his position, and there was a referendum. The CBC openly stated they would not give voice to anyone who was not supportive of that position, and that was actually the majority position among Quebecers, was to be opposed to conscription. So that was an extreme example, and in the book I detail individuals who on the board of CBC that had totally intertwined with the government of the day, and you go continue on into the 50s and 60s. There's a very good thesis that looks at the CBC's ties with the Department of Defense during that period, and shows just how intertwined they were, where they would work with military officials producing documentaries. They would look to get the okay of the military. In some instances, military officials would say this was not they didn't want this piece to be out there, and CBC would withdraw it. So there's quite close historic ties between the CBC and the military, it's not as close today as it was historically, but still today the board is appointed by the government of the day. The budget, of course, comes from the federal government. So if the CBC moves too far outside of what the government wants, there's ways to punish it financially. In the case of Canadian Press, its roots are tied into World War I and the feeling that there wasn't enough pro-British, pro-war, pro-World War I news circulating in Canada, particularly in Western Canada. And it was a major government subsidy during World War I to extend the telegraph line out west to be able to get Reuters, which was then basically run by the British Foreign Office, to extend Reuters into the west of Canada, and with the explicit aim of having more pro-war perspective, unlike the there was much more Associated Press wire copy coming from the U.S. And at that point, the U.S. wasn't part of World War I. So the Canadian Press's founding is directly tied to decision makers' desire for explicitly pro-imperialist, pro-World War One news copy. And obviously, it has delinked from the militaristic outlook of the early days, but there is still this root, and it's still oriented around a nationalist outlook. So in both cases, there's a very clear historical connection with both the CBC and Canadian Press with Canadian foreign policy or promoting Canadian foreign policy and Canadian militarism. I would say that's lessened over time, but there's still the sort of lingering elements to that relationship that distort the outlook in bias of nationalistic type outlook.
Can I just maybe put one more question to you? And because we know that this propaganda apparatus is as much at work in the United States and other countries as it is in Canada, I'm kind of curious to know if the Canadian propaganda model has a uniquely Canadian signature. What would be the distinguishing features of the Canadian model?
That's a tough question. I to be honest, I didn't look at the American, British, or other countries' propaganda models, propaganda systems, all that much, because I'm very focused on sort of researching and uncovering the Canadian examples. The U.S. is obviously very well studied and among the Canadian left. There's lots of people who've obviously read the Chomsky and Herman's Manufacturing Consent and many other books. What the point that I think the one element that I think Canadians have to understand, one component that's important is that Canada is a powerful global player. It's not powerful vis-a-vis in relation to the U.S. and maybe not powerful in relation to Britain, but in terms of a global standard, it is a powerful force. It is part of the G7. It does have something like Radio Canada International, or what was the CBC International Service, or in the Americans, Canadian equivalent to the Americans, Voice of America. The Canadian government does have the capacity, it does have this major diplomatic apparatus around the world, and one of the things diplomatic apparatuses do is they promote Canada across the globe. So you have Radio Canada International promoting Canada, sort of Canadian perspective globally. You have diplomatic apparatus promoting Canadian perspective globally. You have different program, Canadian studies programs, where the Canadian government spends millions of dollars on academics globally to try to develop studies of Canada, and generally will lead to a certain kind of perspective. So Canada is a powerful player on the global scene economically, to a significant extent militarily, and also from the standpoint of its propaganda and its ability to communicate its message to the world. So if you were to compare a country like Canada to a country like Haiti, obviously Canada has an immense imbalance in capacity for the Canadian government to propagate its perspective on the world than the Haitian government, and that's one element of the propaganda model. So obviously people are familiar. Canadians are probably more familiar with Voice of America and the idea that the American government has a international radio program to put out its perspective, and they are familiar with the fact that the Canadian government has a similar, not as significant, but similar program. This, and the roots of this go right back into the Cold War and the psychological war, as former External Minister Lester Pearson put it, against the Eastern Bloc. So I think that's one component that people should be aware of. But I think the model is the most important component, the media. The model is fairly similar between Canada and the U.S. There is this distinction. The CBC is somewhat different. The the media influence of the CBC in Canada is somewhat different than the U.S., where it's almost entirely corporate-owned and corporate-dependent, so dependent on advertising. But the basics, certainly in the newspaper realm, the model is very similar. The Canadian newspapers are owned by some of the richest people in the country. They're dependent on other large corporations for advertising. They are dependent on other powerful institutions for information. So that be an institution like the military that has the capacity to pump out lots of different stories, pump out lots of different events. They are receptive to flack, to pushback, to backlash. That pushback usually comes from other powerful sources. So the basic models of the media propaganda system are very similar in Canada than to the ones that many listeners might be familiar with in the U.S.
Well, Eve, I know you're launching your book very soon. The tour begins Tuesday, October 11th in Montreal at Concordia University, and you're going to be moving across the country. So I wish you all the best with that. The name of the book, again, is A Propaganda System, How Canada's Government, Corporations, Media, and Academia Sell War and Exploitation. Thank you very much for sharing these insights with us.
Thanks for having me.
Eve Engler has a number of tour stops planned over the next several weeks, including Concordia University in Montreal on October 17th, McMaster University in Hamilton and the University of Guelph in Guelph, both on October 20th, Beit Zaytoun in Toronto on October 21st, and the University of Winnipeg in Winnipeg on November 2nd. For a complete list of stops across Canada, visit the website yvesengler.com. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. Special thanks this week to guest interviewer Kim Lee Wong.